come to have a briefing from the Department of Water and Environmental Affairs on the outcomes of the public hearings on the Green Paper on Climate Change. And also we'll be having a briefing from our own department, the Department of Energy, on its role towards the COP17 climate change in Durban in December. I thought we'd also have the first bite on our third term program at LAF. Unfortunately, our logistics failed us on that, but I'll try as soon as we can to circulate a draft, because the sooner we sort out a draft, just a draft, so that people can apply their minds and make inputs, would be helpful. The third and fourth terms of our year would be rather hectic because of the PRRR, the whole new exercise on oversight on the budgets and financial affairs of the department, as well as the very climate change conference itself. So it would be very helpful and strategic to ensure that we plan our way towards the rest of the year as soon as we can. I would like us also at the end to consider and adopt our strategic plan, which we went through thoroughly at our strategic planning session on the last week of April, or third week of April, can't remember exactly. It's quite essential that we do so, because we have not yet adopted our budget for the committee, such that it is submitted to the relevant authorities for approval. We are on a broad money, which is not appropriate. We can't conduct oversight on the department and then conduct oversight on ourselves. That's very, very important. So I trust that both the enough copies for those seven brought theirs today, so that we can look at the plan and adopt it. I've just been going through the agenda with the hope that technology would have come to terms with us, not to be so unpredictable. Yes, Teresa.
Yeah, because we have the copies of the presentation, in case we are not able to see them, we can still make use of the copies of the presentation we have, so that we don't wait too long.
Time is money. That's a good advice. Can I welcome the officials from the Department of Water and Environmental Affairs who are going to take us through the Green Paper? Of course, I'm sure you'll be aware of why we're taking this. This is more necessarily an oversight exercise. It's more to empower ourselves in preparation for our oversight work, because energy forms a substantial component of the climate change issues, and also in view of the COP17 around the corner, which is why we decided to combine the two, so that it can, you know, cases that are related to one another. Without wasting any more time, can I hand over to the Department of Water and Environmental Affairs to introduce themselves and take us through their presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and honorable members. It's a pleasure to be here. And, well, this technology will let us down, but I'm sure most of it is actually mostly written. There are a couple of graphics that I'd love to have shown, but we'll hopefully get a chance to see them. Let me introduce myself. My name is Peter Luhi. I'm the Acting Deputy Director General for Climate Change within the Department of Environmental Affairs. I'm joined here by my colleague, Mark Gordon, who's our Special Advisor on Energy Issues, specifically around energy and mitigation. And what I've done is I've tried to tailor-make a presentation to you, specifically looking at the Green Paper, but specifically looking at the energy issues. And I hope that is what you're looking for. In essence, just to go through what I'm hoping to present to you is that a very, very quick run-through of the policy development process to date, what the finalisation process will entail, a basic understanding of what the Green Paper is looking like, looking at the energy and the Green Paper, basically looking specifically at the energy components of the Green Paper, looking at the energy-related public comments that have come through a number of participatory processes, and then looking at basically the Green Paper and things like the IRP. So, first of all, the National Climate Change Response Policy has a long history. The first kind of public mandate was provided at a conference in 2004 called the National Climate Change Strategy. It was the National Climate Change Strategy that was developed at a conference in 2005 in October in Midrand, in which there were four cabinet members represented. We had a situation where it was agreed that because of the cross-cutting nature of climate change, it was important that there was national policy to ensure that there was alignment and coordination and cohesion around the country's response to climate change. In that process and from that conference, it was also very, very clear that what was required was that there had to be some kind of research work done on what we could potentially do in terms of climate change response. And this led to a process called the long-term mitigation scenarios, which is a scenario-building process, which was a multi-stakeholder process involving government, all government departments were affected, civil society, business and industry, and research institutions as well. And from this, we basically came up with a whole bunch of findings that showed that there was a real potential for us to reduce our carbon emissions quite dramatically. It was all practically possible. The long-term mitigation scenarios looked specifically at the technical interventions that were available, so there wasn't just dreaming or anything like that, and it showed that we could have dramatic reductions in our greenhouse gases at a cost, though. This wasn't going to be cheap. From there, in 2008, Cabinet said that we had to start developing the national policy, and that in terms of this national policy from the mitigation perspective, we had to look at a peak, plateau, and decline trajectory for our carbon emissions. So basically, our greenhouse gas emissions were supposed to peak between 2020 and 2025 and plateau for a period of 10 years, and after that start declining in absolute terms. And that's what Gavin made a decision on. As it turned out, of course, that was completely aligned with the ANC Polokwane Declaration of 2007 around climate change as well. Cabinet in 2008 also agreed to a process for the development of the policy, and in March 2009, we had the National Climate Change Policy Summit, which was the official public launch of the policy development process. At the end of that year was the rather disappointing Copenhagen Conference of the Parties, where there was high hopes that there would be a new international agreement, which was never reached. But the policy process continued after that. And in May 2010, there was a policy development roundtable to do a final participatory process in this. And then in November 2010, the Green Paper was published for public comment. From the time of publication all the way to the end of the public comment process, there's been a very strong participatory process. First of all, there were provincial workshops in every single one of the provinces. And those concluded on the 4th of February. Then, as you're aware, your colleagues in the Water and Environment Portfolio Committee held a series of public hearings from the 3rd to the 16th of March. We also conducted a number of thematic workshops that have been called for by specific interest groups on specific areas, and those included adaptation, mitigation, governance, energy, local government and public awareness, and human resource and technology. Then at the same time, the Green Paper was subject to scrutiny and discussion and debate within the NEDLAC Forum, and that ended from February to April. And then we finally got all the public comments together, of which, if one divides the individual comments, there are over 4,000 individual comments in the Green Paper. They were databased and analysed, and on the 13th and 15th of April, there was an Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change drafting retreat, where officials from all the key affected departments got together and started doing some work on looking at the comments and how we should start addressing those comments. From that process, an initial draft white paper was circulated to the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change 2 weeks ago for a further set of comments and bilaterals. And from there, what's going to happen is that over the next 3 or 4 weeks, we're going to be finalizing those comments, getting a final draft together, and we're hoping that the initial draft white paper will be submitted to Cabinet in July. In terms of what the Green Paper looked like, the structure was quite simple. It was for a subject as complex as climate change, the policy itself is only 36 pages long. So it's really basically had to crystallize a whole bunch of very, very quite complex scientific information into a very, very short, easy to understand way. And that's exactly what's happened. So in section one of the Green Paper is an introduction. It's a 1 to 2 page encapsulation of the core climate change issues, and through this the justification for national policy. Basically, this is saying that, for instance, why are we even bothering about looking at climate change and why is it an issue? And the reality is that climate change, as it stands, is not only a global threat, it's one of the most important global threats that we have. In actual fact, in discussions yesterday, people are looking at certainly around us hosting the conference of the parties in Durban at the end of the year. People are comparing climate change to the 1960s concern around global nuclear annihilation. And it was mentioned in a meeting yesterday that it's quite apt that in terms of a country that is actually hosting the Conference of the Parties, that thinking about the last global threat, South Africa is the only nation in the world to have actually given up its nuclear weapons, and therefore has actually responded to global threats in a most proactive way. So within that sort of situation, there's high hopes for Durban, but it remains to be seen how far we can go. Section 2 talks about the objectives, and the objectives are simply this. The objectives of the Green Paper are basically that South Africa will make a fair contribution to all global efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we will also adapt to the inevitable climate changes that we've already committed to through building awareness, through increasing our emergency response systems, and through basically starting to build resilience to climate changes within our communities and societies and economy. Section 3 then talks about principles, and these are just a concise list of very specific principles. And the principles are things like intergenerational rights, things like, for instance, that the decisions we make now, if they have an impact on the future generations, we have to take that into account. And Section 4 deals with strategy, and it talks about what kind of strategies we'll use to meet the objectives. And these things, of course, are things like strategies of informed decision-making, policies based on proper scientific research, the use of economic instruments to cost carbon, and so on and so forth. And Section 5 is the policy approaches and actions, and this, in the Green Paper, is really the meat of the policy. And this is divided into a number of specific sectors, and for each sector, I'll unpack this a bit more. In Section 6, we have roles and responsibilities. In this, it's important to note that, for instance, when it comes down to roles and responsibilities, it is important to realize that climate change just changes the context in which we do our work. It doesn't change our work. So, the Department of Energy does energy planning for the nation, but climate change, it still does energy planning for the nation. The only difference is that it takes into account the impacts of our carbon emissions. And the same thing for housing and so on and so forth. So nothing really, in terms of roles and responsibilities, the roles and responsibilities remain largely the same. It's just with the context in which we do that changes quite dramatically. Section 7 deals with institutional framework for coordination, and the Green Paper has tried not to create any new structures, so basically it starts looking at the use of the existing structures. And with that, there's the Interministerial Committee on Climate Change, the Forum of South African Directors Generals, Clusters and Outcomes-Based Monitoring, the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change, the Provincial Local Government Cooperation, partnering in, with stakeholders, and the National Climate Change Committee, which is a multi-stakeholder committee that is actually one of the longest-standing public participatory forums between government and civil society. The NCCC was formed in 1994 and it still runs to this day. Section 8, Inputs and Resource Mobilization, talks about the important aspects about funding, human resources, skills, technology resources, and importantly starts talking about information. To a large extent, an effective response to climate change is going to be based very, very much on our level of knowledge, our risk-averse approach to this as well. And so within this, there's a section on the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, which is really our process of doing monitoring, reporting, and verification around our actual greenhouse gas emissions. We also must observe our climate changes. We've already got observations around the country, and our observation is improving dramatically. For example, we have the Global Atmospheric Watch Station, one of six, is based in Cape Point, as you know, run by the South African Weather Service, and that's been monitoring carbon dioxide concentrations for many years. And since the 1950s, basically, it's been seeing a dramatic increase in carbon dioxide concentrations. These are global ones, average. The other observed climate change since the 1950s, we've seen a steady increase in South African temperatures. And I can show you a whole bunch of things around what we're already observing within the country. We need to look at medium and long-term modeling and downscaled risk assessments. So in other words, at the moment we have models that give us predictions that in terms of rainfall patterns, there appears to be a potential that we're going to have increased rain in the eastern side of the country, and rain on the western side of the country is going to remain slightly less or remain much the same. Which sounds okay, except that with increased temperatures, of course, there's increased evaporation, which means in the west of the country, it gets dry. So there's reduced stream flow, and we have massive increases in our deserts and so on and so forth. But we need to actually have systems to monitor exactly how these things are happening. The other aspects, of course, that we have to do monitoring around the seasons. We know that with climate change and changes in temperatures and what have you, suddenly areas that were malaria-free were suddenly going to be areas where malaria starts existing. In terms of this as well, then we also have to do response monitoring. Where we make interventions to respond to climate change, we have to know if those are effective. And so we have to monitor the efficiency and effectiveness of our responses. We have to strengthen our early warning management systems. And at the moment, I mean, South Africa is blessed with some fantastic systems that are all indigenous and locally based. The fire warning systems, the severe weather warning systems, the flood warning systems that have already been set up by the National Disaster Management Center and the South African Weather Services are state-of-the-art and some of the best in the world. But we need to strengthen these, especially for our rural communities who are going to be most affected by climate change. It goes without saying that people who live in cities under permanent structures, what have you, are far more resilient to major climate changes than people that do not have those permanent housing, etc. Information and communication technology is an exceptionally important thing around early warning systems, but also just basically as a climate change response to. Section 9 in the Green Paper deals with monitoring, evaluation, and review, and this basically sort of talks about how we're going to monitor our greenhouse gas interventions and how we're going to verify the impacts of our mitigation efforts. And that largely is the structure of the Green Paper. Looking at the meat of it, which is the policy approaches and actions, it's divided up into sectors. And there are, the first one is key adaptation sectors, and this deals with the three that are seen as the priority ones, which are water, where the impact of, as a water-poor country, climate change impacts on water is a major concern. Our impact on agriculture is dramatic in terms of food security. We still have a large percentage of our people that are subsistence farmers that are relying on the food that they grow. Human health, we're already in a country that actually has a health crisis, which is acknowledged. And climate change just basically exacerbates those issues. The whole aspect of heat stress and what have you on already stressed populations is quite dramatic. In terms of the mitigation sectors, these are all obvious, and you'll see from my next slide. The first mitigation sector is obviously energy. most of our emissions come from energy. Industry, commerce, manufacturing, mining, mineral resources, and tourism is also an area of emissions. And transport is one of the areas of emissions that is growing very, very quickly. Disaster management is an early response to climate change. We've seen the increases of natural disasters around the world. These are normally extreme weather events. Things like tsunamis and earthquakes should not be confused with climate change. So in other words, the tragedy of Japan should not be confused with climate change. There's no scientific link at this stage between seismic activity and climate change. However, things like Hurricane Katrina and what have you are extreme weather events, and those we're going to see more of. Natural resource sectors, these are the areas of potential impact and where we need to respond. Our terrestrial biodiversity is dramatically threatened. As many of you know, in the area that we're in now, we're sitting in a thing called the Cape Floral Kingdom, which is the smallest plant kingdom on the planet, and it's the only plant kingdom on Earth that is contained at the borders of one country. In terms of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the chances of us losing 80% of our fynbos by 2100 is very large, which means that the entire Cape Floral Kingdom ceases to be within the next 50, 70 years. These are dramatic. In terms of other aspects of biodiversity, there are dramatic increases, for instance, in bushy vegetation because of the fertilization effect of carbon in the air. And these are the things that we have to respond to. Massive increases in alien invasive species. In terms of marine biodiversity, the same sort of situation happens. There is an increase in ocean temperatures. There's an area where we have very little South African research, and it's an area where we're starting to put a lot of concentration. Major threats here in terms of the marine environment, of course, the first one that springs to mind is sea level rise. So, for instance, the idea that we'll have this meeting in 100 years' time sitting in boats inside this room. Sea level rise is a dramatic threat, of course, but there's also other aspects as well. Increases in sea level, increases in ocean temperatures means impacts on our marine resources. The absorption of carbon into the oceans means that the seas are also getting more acid, which means that if they continue to get more acid, then basically shellfish cannot make their shells anymore, so it's the entire extinction of species that make shells from calcium. Commercial forestry, in terms of the predictions, our commercial forestry will have to change, although it won't be impacted dramatically, but it will certainly not be able to grow in the same place it is now. It'll have to go to new places. Fisheries could be severely impacted, but we're not entirely sure exactly how that's going to be done. Human society, livelihoods and services, of course, is most dramatic. It deals with human settlements and infrastructure and the built environment in urban areas, and urban areas are seen as dramatic because of the density of population. And it's also seen as a place, for instance, that is actually very, very slow to adapt. And you can understand why. In smaller, less densely populated people are more flexible in terms of their adaptation. They can move. They can sort out their houses. But in cities where there are millions of people and there's massive amounts of infrastructure, it's very slow to adapt. So, for example, the things that we're seeing now with extreme weather events is for the first time, certainly in my life, I saw a car swept off a highway. Because our stormwater drains no longer can cope with the kind of deluge of water that we're getting. So that's what's happening. So cities, of course, have a dramatic role to play in terms of looking at the built environment. Rural areas, really, really important, is that their actual level of resilience in terms of houses and closest to rivers and the kind of urban planning that can protect people is not there. So, of course, there's a dramatic impact there. In terms of coastal areas, I've said that sea level rises and storm surges, extreme weather events are probably one of the biggest threats there as well. And we've seen this. We've seen there's photographs of waves running through fishing that we've never seen before. So this is all part of this. And in terms of the work that's been done by the City of Cape Town, I'm using them as an example. There's been some excellent work done all the way up the coast. But the City of Cape Town have shown what would happen with sea level rise, and it's quite dramatic. The impact's already being observed in Fishhook, at Woodbridge Island, and at the Strand. It's already been seen, the impact of sea level rise. Then finally, we also cover aspects of waste. Waste is also a source of our greenhouse gas emissions. It's only really responsible for 2% of our greenhouse gas emissions, but to a large extent, it's one of those emissions that we really don't need to have. I mean, the emissions here are from methane, and mostly from our landfill sites. And methane, of course, is a flammable gas which can be used as an energy source. At the moment, we're just pumping it into the air, and it's a very powerful greenhouse gas. So for each one of those sectors that I mentioned, there's a brief five-line introductory paragraph describing the climate change relevance of that particular sector. Then there's a few concise bullet points on the sector's impact on climate change, or its climate change impact on the sector, adaptation requirements, or both. And then there's text along the lines of, in response to these challenges, South Africa will, and then there's a numbered list of key interventions that are dense, concise descriptions of what we will do as a nation in meeting the objective for each one of those sectors. So before I move into the energy stuff, I want to just give you some indication of what the energy challenge really is. And this is where I would really like slides. And it's such a pity that we don't have them. But in essence, I need to get an indication of what you see. Okay. Our total emissions of greenhouse gases in our last official formal inventory, which is basically 2000, which was the inventory called for by the United Nations, is 461 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalents that we put into the air. Of that, 2%, as I mentioned, is from waste, and that's from the methane from our landfill sites mostly. 8% is from agricultural activities, and this is change in land use, but also something called enteric fermentation. And there's no polite way of putting this, but it's basically cattle farts that have caused methane because of the way the stomachs are designed. 7% is from industrial processes and product use. So there's certain industrial processes that specifically produce carbon dioxide. So a typical example is the cement industry, which in the calcining process of calcine of lime to make cement releases carbon dioxide. But really, the bulk of our emissions is from energy. And then breaking up those energy emissions a little further. We have a wedge of around 3% that is energy from fuel combustion in commercial, institutional, residential, agricultural, fishing, and other. And so basically this is where we are burning fossil fuels in our homes, in our commercial activities, in our residential areas. 8% comes from fuel combustion from manufacturing industries and construction. So this is where we are burning fuels for building roads and construction activities and so on and so forth. 9% of this number is growing, this is the most rapidly growing number, is from transport, and this is from our motor vehicles. Every time we switch on our car and we fill it up with a fossil fuel, we release some carbon. And at that stage in 2000, this was 9%. You can imagine since 2000, remember 2000 was, in terms of our economy, was actually quite a slack year. It was only 2 years later when we started putting 50,000 new vehicles on the road every single month. So that figure has been growing quite dramatically. 9% is from fugitive emissions from fossil fuels. This is a figure that is under dispute and hopefully was going to be reduced. But as it stands in terms of our current inventory, these are fugitive emissions that makes one thing, that's methane from our coal mines. And so basically when we mine coal mines, especially from open cast mines, we release gas into the air, the methane gas into the air, and this is causing greenhouse gas. And then when we refine oil as well, we have fugitive emissions from the oil refining process, and that's responsible for 7% of our emissions. These are quite dramatic numbers. But once again, the largest share there is fuel combustion. This is from the energy industries. And the energy industries themselves are basically our coal to liquid plants. So basically Secunda and Sasol, which is responsible for 8% of our total emissions. And as you've probably heard, this is a quite dramatic statement that Sasol Secunda is the world's largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions, well, in the world. And the bulk of it, 37% of our total emissions come from our large fleet of coal-fired power stations. So that's the challenge that we face in terms of our energy emissions. Well, in terms of our emissions in general. Since the 2000 inventory, we've done a quick update to see exactly where our trends are. And our trend is basically, in terms of the graph that you have before you, is that energy has been has been the area where we have the most dramatic increases since 2000. What it says IPPU is the industrial process. Product use has remained slightly increased, but nothing dramatic. Agriculture, forestry, and land use, that AFOLU, has remained relatively constant, and waste has remained relatively constant as well. So in terms of the increases of our greenhouse gas emissions, it's really emissions from energy. And to a large extent, the first question that should spring to mind is that, okay, sure enough, there's been a dramatic increase in transport emissions, does that cover that entire increase? And the answer is no. It's actually an increase in our emissions from coal-fired power stations, not because we built any new ones in this period. It's simply that we're using the existing ones more. So in terms of the green paper content, as I said, in each one of the sectors, it says, so in response to these challenges, and you've kind of got an indication of what the challenges are, we as a nation must do the following. And there are a list of these, and I'll run through them very, very quickly. We have to integrate a climate constraint into our energy planning tool, basically integrated energy plan, and the integrated resource plan for electricity generation. And in essence, we've already done that. So the latest version of the integrated resource plan, the IRP2, actually has a carbon constraint. And so in other words, this statement of policy of our intention is already being reflected in our planning process, which is a very important aspect. The second part is that ensure that the integrated resource plan for electricity generation and its future iterations are modeled so as to take account of the peak plateau and decline trajectory. So in other words, in terms of how we do our planning in the future, we have to look at our energy to see how it's going to contribute to this peak plateau and decline trajectory for our greenhouse gases. We have to use economic instruments to internalize the cost of carbon. This is a point that talks about and challenges the basic myth that coal is a very cheap fuel. It is a very cheap fuel in the market, but it's not a cheap fuel in terms of its actual costs to society. The reality is that climate change is largely as a result of the burning of fossil fuels. And the way it was described by Lord Nicholas Stern was that climate change is probably the largest single market failure. And he said that simply because we have not taken into account the real costs of that resource. So in other words, we've been burning fossil fuels willy-nilly at a market cost rather than taking its real cost into account. So the policy intends to try and actually internalize that externalized cost and through that make other sources of energy far more economically viable. Establish a business environment that facilitates the development of a local renewable energy technology, manufacturing, implementation, export industry. Of course, this is all very, very much part of the industrial policy action plan as well. So in other words, the IPAP has already taken up these kind of interventions into account. Of course, this work is already covered in the green economy work that's been done by government and is included in the new growth path, and so on and so forth. So a lot of this stuff from the Green Paper in November is already appearing in new plans and policies as well. Another intervention is to design and roll out ambitious research, development and demonstration programs that result in new, novel and innovative approaches to the diversification of our energy mix. What is this saying is that to a large extent, and one can sort of say that one can blame this on apartheid planning in terms of our energy mix, that what you wanted was to have these mega power stations that were easily defended against the forces of change. That approach has to be challenged. And within that whole aspect of diversification of our energy mix, we have to start looking at really what our natural resources are. And when one looks at our real natural resources, one considers that if we have 200 years of coal, we basically have enough sunlight in a day that is equivalent to basically our coal reserves for a year. And it's always there. South Africa has one of the highest solar installations in the world. This is a massive resource. If one looks at countries' energy sources, if one looks at, for instance, Norway, their major natural resource is hydro. And so, therefore, hydropower is where they get their energy from. If one looks at Iceland, their major resource is thermal energy. So, therefore, their energy is from thermal energy. South Africa, our major source is from solar energy, and our major energy supply is from coal. There's obviously a mismatch there. And so this is what this is about, is looking at research programs of how we can start harnessing this country's real, real wealth. Identify and resolve the financial, regulatory, and institutional barriers that may impede the implementation of renewable energy feed-in tariffs at a level adequate to incentivize large-scale investment. Review and scale up the target that we set for renewables. Renew and revise renewable energy policy, legal and regulatory frameworks that allow for differentiated but specific targets, parameters, and tariffs for all renewable energy technology options. Scale up and accelerate the implementation of the Working for Energy program, which is basically one of the Working For programs, which is much the same as the Working for Water program, which is basically local employment, specifically in rural areas. And within these Working for Energy aspects, there are some real chances. One of the things is to start taking a climate change impact and turning it into a positive. As I mentioned earlier, Chair, One of the impacts that we're measuring in terms of climate change is increased woody vegetation, certainly in the eastern side of the country. So if one looks at the farms in, for instance, the Lofot, they used to be very, very much open savanna with an occasional thorn tree. If one looks at them now, they're very dense bush. Which means that, for instance, this gives us, it's bad for farmers, specifically beef farmers, because they're losing their grazing land. But if, for instance, we can employ rural people to actually harvest that and turn that into a second generation biofuel, for example, it means that we can have rural development, rural employment, and a renewable energy. So there are some real opportunities that we have to look at, and that's what we need to look at in terms of this working for energy. Explore and further develop the potential for nuclear energy in terms of the national energy policy, and of course that's already in place. Introduce innovative approaches for the establishment of sustainable structures and financing mechanisms. Invest in new and clean coal technologies and efficient technologies where the coal power is still built. And reinforce this through introducing more stringent thermal efficiency and emission standards for coal-fired power stations, and of course this is already happening. In terms of the power stations with Madupi and Casita that we're building, we'll have the best, or the far better efficiencies than ever before. Set ambitious and mandatory targets for energy efficiency in other subnational sectors. This is what we regard as a complete low-hanging fruit. Energy efficiency makes good sense whether we have climate change or not. As a country, we are energy inefficient. And it's, even though people may deny this, this is the real fact, is that we use far more electricity to produce the same amount of product as anybody else in the world. And we do this for the simple reasons that we got used to the idea that, for instance, electricity was cheap. And so therefore, that it was never a cost driver in the way that we did our production. That's changing, and it's changing dramatically. So looking at energy efficiency is the best way that we can actually start reducing our energy demand, and start looking at demand-side management. And so thereby reduce our production and thereby emissions of greenhouse gases. At the same time, it makes good economic sense because it increases our competitiveness and reduces our costs. So this is an area where we need to really, really focus our energy, certainly in the short term, because it's one of those things where it's actually a cost-positive aspect for the economy. We have to improve energy efficiency, knowledge and understanding in the various sectors. Legislate requirements for the installation of energy management systems in large-scale office buildings. There's a huge potential for us to actually improve the energy efficiency of our commercial buildings. In fact, the environment, the Water Environment Portfolio Committee is very, very keen on the idea of actually doing an audit of Parliament and to actually look at how we can actually do some retrofits of Parliament to reduce the Parliament's carbon footprint. It'd be fantastic if we could do that before COP. That's fantastic to hear, Jake. Then there's the whole thing about looking at systems that are already old and that must be replaced to replace them with a far better one. So within the whole sort of thing of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems, heat pumps, variable speed drives, and so on and so forth. The greenhouse gas information system I talked about, we need to actually know exactly what our emissions profile looks like. We've got a pretty good idea, but we need to go into far further detail to actually proper implementation plan and very detailed interventions as well. Ensure that the greenhouse gas emissions information management provides measurable, reportable, and verifiable information. Develop initiatives to roll out energy management training and awareness program. I mean, this in itself, looking at energy management services, is in itself a new industrial area. Introduce minimum energy performance standards for appliances and equipment. This is already underway. Develop and implement mandatory appliance labelling, also underway. Promote the development and implementation of appropriate standards and guidelines and codes of practice for the appropriate use of renewable energy. SABS is already working on those, and there's been published ones on wind already. Develop a legislative policy and regulatory framework to support carbon capture and storage. This is certainly an area that has got a huge amount of interest from companies like Sasol, for example. Extend research, development, and demonstration efforts on new construction materials using housing design and energy-efficient buildings. Within this sort of situation, though, once again, there's also a real chance and opportunity here. Here's an example. In terms of the new power stations that are being built, one of the things that is very new from an environmental and pollution control approach is that they are going to be fitted with flue gas desulfurization, which actually takes the sulfur out of the emissions, because we actually have a sulfur dioxide problem, so one of our major pollutant issues. The waste product, or what is regarded as a waste product from that process, is gypsum. And there are thousands and thousands of tons of gypsum produced by this flue gas desulfurization process. In terms of the authorization given to Eskom for the build of these power stations, that gypsum is then basically landfilled. It's a waste product. The reality is that gypsum is the base material for ceilings and for dry walling systems. So basically what this is, it's cheap building material, exceptionally effective building material that we're throwing away. If, for instance, we could actually have a public works program that takes this waste product, which we're throwing away, turns it into system, and turns it into ceilings, and we can start retrofitting low-cost homes and improving the thermal efficiency of low-cost homes, this would have dramatic implications, not only to raise the quality of life of the poor, but also to reduce the energy demand, but also to, we'll have a waste product that's actually producing a valuable commodity. So that's this kind of work as well. So within the climate change response situation, it's not all gloom and doom. What it really is change. But a lot of that change is good change. So that is the basis of what was in the green paper around the energy, specifically around the energy stuff. Of course, there's a whole bunch of stuff that would be of interest to this portfolio committee as well, around transport and what have you, but I've tried to focus very much on the energy ones. And I've done the same in terms of teasing out some of the broad comments that we received through this very, very long participatory process in terms of the public comments in the green paper. One of the issues that was raised was energy poverty. And this is a bizarre sort of situation that in the South African thing, and of course, I mean, South Africa in this regard must be seen as a microcosm of global issues around climate change. That it's been the developed countries that have actually led to massive greenhouse gas emissions that are leading to these sort of situations, and it's the poor and developing countries that are really the victims of this sort of situation. And this is largely the case here as well, is that, for instance, in terms of energization of the poor at the moment, percentage-wise, in terms of disposable income, spend more money on energy than the rich do. And it's for the simple reason that, I mean, people who live in, for instance, in a house that has no ceiling, no insulation whatsoever, a house that is freezing in winter and exceptionally hot in summer, means that their heating bill, just to basically survive, is far higher than people that live in houses that are, well, thermally insulated, what have you. They don't need that kind of situation. So that's an area that has to be addressed. So it must be one of the aspects of poverty alleviation and that we have to look at in terms of our climate change response. A concern was raised and throughout this, and it's a very, very valid concern, is that we've, in terms of the energy section within the Green Paper, to a large extent deals specifically or largely with electricity. And so there was a comment that was in brackets. In South Africa, there is a misconception that energy equals electricity, and this is true. So that's one of the things we have to do in the white papers to make sure that there's no, that we deal with energy as a whole, and we deal with electricity as a subset of that energy, as an energy carrier. And that's what we need to do, not electricity on its own. And so we've learned some interesting lessons here, because we're not energy experts. But our colleagues from the Department of Energy have been hugely, have assisted us dramatically in this whole process. A common concern is raised that who would be accountable for the strategy? And basically, in this instance, is where does the buck stop? It's a national climate change policy, but who is responsible for actually implementing these things? And the example that was used was the renewable energy policy of 2004 never even reached 20% of its targets. Who do we hold accountable for that? And so this is a question that came through and throughout the whole process. And the reality, of course, is that within the climate change response, it's individual departments and ministers that have to be held accountable for their particular areas of focus. I think what was looked, what people were trying to get us to say they wanted a name so they could go out and clap somebody around and things were happening. But that's not the way it's going to work. I mean, as I said, climate change response changes the context of the work that we do, but it doesn't change the work we do. So therefore, the accountability remains exactly the same. There was much comment on how a fair contribution to global mitigation efforts could be interpreted. And this is a very interesting one. In terms of our fair contribution, the fair contribution is given by the President in 2009 as a reduction from our business as usual baseline of 34% in 2020 and 42% reduction in 2025. And that is seen as a fair contribution. That's reflected in the green paper. But a number of people asked for what is the base for this 34%? Because no one's ever seen this business as usual baseline. So it's a percentage of a number that no one's ever seen. And this is a valid concern. Basically, this is saying, where is our real target? You know, we've seen some graphs that are very vague. I'll show you one of those. Well, actually, I can't show you one of those, but it is in the document. And people said we need to be far more certain about what we need to do in order for our action to really make a difference. The target itself is controversial, with some questioning the rationale, the baseline model. This is technicians, as I said, that you know they're not quite sure how our model works and what the basis is. The reality is that our emission trajectory is a political decision, it's not a scientific decision. This is where we want to go. The extent of the influence of the DEA on the Department of Energy's IRP process was questioned. Basically, they sort of said that we weren't strong enough in that process as the Department of Environment. They sort of said we should have been more radical in our response within the Department of Energy's process. The reality is that the Department of Energy's process around the IRP was a very good scientific process and with the proper modeling and what have you. And it's not our role to go through and lobby like lobbyists. We're government. And so we worked like government. And of course, within that whole situation of the Department of Environment, we played our role as any other department there. So we don't really believe that the statement is there. It actually got any validity. The role of nuclear power was strongly questioned, although there's also at least one advocate for nuclear. There's been an increased number of questions about this following the Japanese situation, as is always the case. But this obviously we need to address. The reference to clean coal was disputed. There was a very strong perception that there's no such thing as clean coal. Perhaps the phrase cleaner coal is a far more appropriate one. Concerns raised in terms of the precautionary principle about the inclusion of carbon capture and storage as a mitigation intervention. Carbon capture and storage is still very, very much a technology in its infancy. And it is yet, and we know this, it has to be improved on a very, very large scale. It certainly would have to be proven in South African context as well. And people were concerned that, for instance, are we banking too much on this unknown technology, and are we not taking a risk-averse approach? And so there was a concern around that. Then finally, there was clarity around our mitigation objective and sectoral targets was a recurring theme. This whole sort of situation about who does what, in terms of this peak plateau and decline, who carries the burden of the reduction in emissions? Is it industry? Is it individuals? Is it the electricity sector? Is it so forth? And so there was this whole thing about there was a very, very strong need for actually defining our mitigation objectives. And to a large extent, I mean, this the slide that you have there, you don't have the slide that I wanted to show you first, but basically there are a number of graphics that people are popularized versions of what our mitigation objectives should look like. And the first one from 2007 was the long-term mitigation scenario thing called Required by Science, which is basically a curve. Then in 2008, Cabinet came up with a peak plateau and decline model, which was illustrated. There were never numbers put in this, but it was illustrated to as it does the green graph. Then in 2009, of course, we had the President's commitment to the Copenhagen Undertaking, which is placed there if it's calculated against the LTMS growth without constraints model. And then finally, what we're proposing is to try and start getting real numbers there, and through a process that we're hoping to put into the white paper that actually defines our peak plateau and decline trajectory quite clearly. And within that, we want to make it quite clear that this is not a commitment. This is basically the baseline that we'll measure the efficacy of our interventions. That's what this is about. And it really comes down to the sort of situation of what does the figure of 5 million jobs mean? 5 million jobs is the target that we as government have to head towards. Was it based on a huge scientific investigation? No, it wasn't. Of course, there was some work behind that number, but the idea now is that with that number, we have to start looking at the detailed plans of how we get there. And it's the same concept here. It's like we put the number out, people can work towards it, and there's no uncertainty around this. And in essence, Chair, that is energy in the green paper. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lucky. I'm pronouncing it correct?
Yes,
okay, thank you. That was quite illustrative. That was quite helpful. But I thought, amongst other things, I asked our secretary to ask is to get key issues that arose out of the public hearings, just to have a sense of the various inputs. We were invited to the public hearings, but as you know, a very lengthy, I could only make it once with a very painful and heavy heart. Because as you get sense, all of us, we really wanted to be there throughout 100% because of the significance of energy on climate change, but unfortunately not. But I'll be quick to say that we are also planning, though albeit one day, a workshop on climate change for all parliamentarians. So we're just having the first bite here, and I can safely assume it will be part of our resource personnel in that. But without wasting any more time, thanks very much once again. I don't know whether your colleague would like to add one or two things before I allow questions from members. Now, can we allow members questions? I'm sure a lot of members, this is a little bit exciting. A couple of things we know, but the twist and the angle from which they come now, you know, is really quite helpful, and I hope something quite productive will come out of this. But questions for now. Ndadislao, followed by Ndadekhadebe. Honourable members, are you that cold? Okay, can you get someone to turn on the heater? My honourable members are not as vibrant. You know, Mr. Luke, this is a very vibrant committee. Remdao.
The slides are not pages themselves, but there are pages on the two sides of the page, but there are pages that they have not required. We have page 64, five.
Thanks. Page 64. Reference was made that the Chinese disaster should not be categorized as having to do with climate change by any means. Just that was some interesting question there. What would be these kinds of things? A lot of things are happening. Recently, there was the ash wind that stopped the flight in Cape Town. There's the Chinese problem that they are currently grappling with. There are words such as volcano, tsunami, a whole range of words. They call them in different names every time they happen. What is related and what is unrelated about this? We have seen in this year very heavy rains and floods in certain areas. Are they also unrelated? And if so, what is related? That is the question, Chairperson. The other question, one of the things I was looking at was the issues of South Africa, especially up north. Up north of South Africa, in the inland, has got dry winters. Resulting from these dry winters, there's always lots of fire burning there, burning grass. How does that impact on the emission? And the impact also of the globes. There are these new globes that are mentioned. Not the fluorescent, the new one. There's a new one now, the energy saving one. I wonder if they are. Yeah. The new energy saving globes. Are they really making an impact? And if so, why are we not looking towards some kind of either regulation or legislation to make it compulsory for South Africa? to use those globes and do away with those others that are in the market currently. On page 15, there's a reference to clean coal. This clean coal, what is this clean coal? How clean is that clean coal? How is it different from the rest of the coal? We know that coal is emitting greenhouse gas quite a lot, and this clean coal, how clean is it? Can it be able to mitigate to our problems? But lastly, Chairperson, is that as the mention was made that the Department of Environmental Affairs and Water is coming to us, I thought at the end of the presentation we are going to have some proposed positions to the climate change conference for discussions which would ultimately become the South African position as it talks to other countries around this particular matter. And the paper does not seem to go as far as that yet. Thanks.
Mr. Slaw, you're putting more pressure on me now as part of the steering committee for climate change in Parliament. Let me say this, sooner the steering committee on climate change. There's my Honourable Freiling, he's also nodding, so at least I will support. The sooner we move, I know he whispered something to me recently. The sooner we move out, move into the public, and that is the Parliament public, and tell what our plans are, the better. The Parliament as a whole, both houses, moves are afoot that we prepare for our participation and contribution to COP17. Of course, it's going to be COP17 and beyond. It won't be just an event-driven issue. We should have long established, you know, a climate change initiative in Parliament. We have moved rather slowly on that. So at least for that, we'll have to move a bit faster. It's good when it comes from ordinary members to show that we really need to move a little bit faster. How clean is fuel? I mean, it's coal. If you could just link that to what I was going to ask as well, the implications of cleaner fuels, if it's linked, you know, what does that mean? Can you go a little bit deeper into it? You know, then how do I go? See you in a second.
But the ex-chair, I think Honorable Slaw has just taken some few of my questions. Because I also, I also had a very question in terms of this, you know, relationship between the Lady Hurricane Katrina. I don't know why they feminized that issue. But I also wanted to get a clarity in terms of those differences. The other question, Chair. It's related to what is the issue of the clean technology. Né? You spoke about the alternative fuel, that the current fuel that is being produced that is not clean, you know, that is having a very impact. I think it's on page 9 that you can be able also to assist us in terms of what is the oil. Excuse me. What is the alternative cleaner fuel that can be also used, but also be cheaper or affordable to our communities? Because as you are saying, the current fuel that you are using, it's cheaper, but it's not a clean fuel. But then, what is the alternative for? I mean, into that. The other question, Chair. It's relating to your page 11 in terms of the renewable energy and efficiency technology. Because I heard you speaking about in terms of the opportunities that it has. If you can give me more clarity, because you know you just browse through. But I need to get, because it's going to have a very impact in terms of the rural development communities. What is it exactly that it's supposed to do? I think if one can grasp, because it must be able to be translated to the ordinary communities at the ground. Because you can say there are opportunities of SMEs and local cooperative, but how? You know, that's the gist that we have to be able to understand. But Chair, I think those are some of my questions, because the Honourable is checking some of my questions. Thanks.
No, add more if he's taken. If you.
Okay. Let's just recap. Rev. Tau, Dr. Lucas, Dr. Freeling, Mema Twel.
Right. Thank you, Chair. The issue of the clean coal has been raised, and I think it's important that we all get clarity on this thing, because it comes up from time to time. Something else I wanted to raise regarding the FLBs, you know, the fluorescent lumber, the mercury in there, one of the big issues is how we dispose of them. And it seems like there's because we are so weak on recycling, and many of our people don't even know that these things contain mercury, which is quite a substance, so maybe you could touch on that. The other issue is something that sort of has been creeping up from time to time, and especially since the discussion of COP17 and that kind of thing, and in terms of our challenge to grow our economy, that obviously we need energy to grow our economy, and our energy, as you rightly pointed out, is based on coal, and coal is a huge pollutant and stuff like that. And then you sometimes hear, get this thing right at the sort of the back of the yes, let's do something about, you know, the environment, but you hear this thing like the developed nations messed up, now they want us, we need the developing world to clean up. Do you get that sense too? Because that could be a showstopper to some of the efforts that we're trying to implement in terms of the challenges that we face in the environment. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, I think I must first of all say thank you for the presentation, because it's made it easier to understand. And I think this is important with any educational program. And this is what should happen right down to the grassroots, so people can understand why are we saying it. The danger is that where you travel most of these, you travel along, in the day, the street lights are all on. You wonder about why is this happening? I do know that to control your flow of electricity, especially on the high voltage lines, you can't just make those dips because it interferes with your supply. But there should be something, some way to monitor that we have the correct flow of electricity, and these lights should automatically come on when there's daylight. The solar system, I support it 100%, especially when it comes to water. But when it comes to delivering electricity, I think we haven't developed a storage, a battery, at this point in time, which can hold the capacity, which can hold the electricity. And this is the biggest drawback. At one time, we had a couple of houses that were there, and the biggest problem wasn't in the solar system per se, but it was the battery. And we couldn't hold the electricity. The most, I think what we're getting there now is, when are we going to start implementing? I think we shouldn't wait for this big bang effect. We should, as we've proven that there's something that we can implement, we should do it almost immediately. Because if we wait until time is running, the chairperson said earlier, the longer we wait, the more expensive it becomes. Transport, we should get hold of the manufacturers. Because manufacturers short-circuit the system at times. When there's something good coming up, they come in, they buy the product, and they stall. They don't even. Electric cars, we should be looking at it 100%. We should be saying, and it's possible, it can happen. But we are restricted because of these big companies. I'm glad you mentioned something about nuclear, because I think we should look at it. and see where we go and prove, because I am not only convinced that it is a no-no. I know that the waste issue is a serious issue, and if we could, there again, we need to know how we would have had. But it's education, education, education. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair.
It was to engage quite extensively in the Environment Committee on these issues, so I won't bring up what I've said there. I think, just to reiterate the point that when we talk about the institutional arrangements around the Green Paper, I think that, you know, you talk about knocking heads together, about not meeting targets. I think this should be the prime institution which knocks heads together. And I think that what this Green Paper can do for us as a committee, and which I hope it will do, is give us a framework in which to chastise the Energy Department in terms of some of these commitments that they've made in this Green Paper. And so I think that this does give us that basis, which is great for that. But if I look at some of the things that are in here at the moment, I think we've already got some things to kind of challenge the Energy Department on. I mean, when it talks about the review and scale up to 10,000 gigawatt hours renewable energy target, I mean, if anything at this stage, it doesn't look certain that we're going to even reach this target, let alone review and scale it up. So, I mean, I think this is something that we can certainly challenge the department on. Also, where the review of the white paper on renewable energy, where that review is, it's sitting in the system somewhere and still hasn't come out for over a year now. So that is something that we can certainly challenge them on. I also see that you haven't really explicitly mentioned the solar water heater program in here. I mean, it's mentioned in terms of demand side management. And we had a very good presentation last week around the problems there, and particularly the underfunding of the solar water heater program. So I think that is something we need to look at and talking about, explicitly saying enough funds be made available to meet our targets with regards to solar water heaters. And then just lastly, on the Parliament side, I mean, I fully agree with you that Parliament needs to be a lead institution, not only in terms of policies, but also in terms of the actions we take here. You know, it was interesting, I was also sit on the steering committee, and they've tasked me with trying to green Parliament. And I did a tour about 2 weeks ago around this institution. There were some good things, so I have to give credit where credit's due, but on the whole, there are some horrific things in terms of environmental management here. So I would love to work with the department if the department wants to come in and give some of their expertise in terms of sorting out some of these things, particularly on things like waste and that. So I look forward to working with you on that regard.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Though some of us are grappling with this climate change, I heard about the clean coal. My question will be, there was this that the new power stations like Medupi is using the new technology so that it must clean the coal. Is it why China is stockpiling coal when we are busy with the global change? Are they taking advantage of us not keeping our coal, so that when coal is no more there, then they will have used this new technology to have energy? The other one is about the mines. How safe are the mines going to be with this global warming? Are they not going to be affected a lot? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I do share the same concerns that have been expressed by Honorable Lucas, and also welcome acknowledge that indeed solar is a major resource to us. But speaking to some experts, they do indicate that the issue of storage is a constraint on the development of our solar energy, and that it will take some few years before we overcome that challenge. I hear you emphasizing it as if it's not a matter that's that we are really content to. That's just my question. That's into that of Honorable Lucas. The second issue you do mention, make mention of energy intensity around by commercial and I think even the mining industry. The question that I have is that, take into consideration the structure of our economy, it's mainly dominated by the heavy users of energy, the mining industry. And which is going to be a reality for some time until the structure of our economy evolves into something else. Now, my question is, are we making any progress in terms of ensuring that there's a change in production processes and technologies that are being utilized by the mining industry, for instance? The third question that I have, it's around transport. I know it's an area that you didn't focus on for obvious reasons. But my question is, are we making significant progress in terms of public investment in public transport infrastructure to the extent that we'll be able to mitigate on emissions that emanate from transport? The last question is, you make somewhere in the presentation, I would have lost track of it, you're talking about introducing innovative approaches for establishment of sustainable structure and financing mechanism. I just want to find out what's the progress around this matter, because the reality of the situation, if you expect emerging developing countries to invest significantly in renewable energy, they would need assistance, because there's just no way a lot of them will be able to afford these technologies without external finance. So I just want to establish from you, what's the progress thus far? Because how do you dissuade them from using these other energy sources which are polluting?
Over to you, sir.
Thank you very, very much. Chair, I'm hoping I can do justice to nearly all of them, but I mean, a lot of the energy-specific related questions, I'm going to just refer to my colleague, who's the expert. And all I'll be doing is translating what she would say to me anyway to you, but I'll go through the list, because they were addressed to me, and I'll do as much as I can. And then with your permission, if I could hand over to my colleague from Energy. The first one is around some clarity around the impacts of climate change. What are those impacts and the whole aspect of natural disasters and climate change. Just imagine, what we're doing is we're heating up, we're causing an increase in the temperature of the global temperatures on average. And what that does is it affects weather. So the things that are involved in changes in the weather patterns that we have in the climate, what we're sort of saying, from our side, is to say weather changes from day to day, if not from minute to minute. I mean, if you're in Cape Town, that's from second to second, the weather changes. But climate doesn't. Now, Cape Town, for centuries and centuries, well, millions of years, has been a winter rainfall area. So you don't get huge, massive storms in summer, and you certainly don't get massive thunderstorms in summer. Or do you? That's climate change. When things start changing that dramatically, that's climate change. And the funny thing about it is that often a lot of people say, Peter, you need to do lectures out in the rural areas about climate change. The reality is that the people in the rural area are more akin and are more tied in to climate change than people are in the cities. Because for many instances, their lives depend on them. Their lives depend on the certainty of weather, when to plant crops and things like that. And suddenly when that just doesn't happen, then there's a problem. And so if you go to rural communities and you ask them about climate change, and I do a talk on climate change, the amount of examples of climate change come from the ground are far higher in rural areas than they are in cities. So, and that's what this is about. And it's, so it's all around the aspects of weather and extreme weather events. So if we start getting very bizarre rainfall patterns, if we start getting bizarre situations of temperature things, and I'll give you some of those impacts. Western Cape, a major fruit-growing area. The reason why it's a fruit-growing area is because it has periods of intense cold, like today, for 2 or 3 days, which allows buds to set and plants to fruit. If you don't have those 3 or 4 days of very, very cold weather, then fruit does not set. For the last couple of years, we've not had that in the Western Cape. We've had to induce fruit chemically through hormones. So in other words, that is a huge dramatic change in the weather, which of course has dramatic impacts for farms and farmers. So within that sort of situation, those are the kind of things that you're looking at. Extreme weather events, as I mentioned, the one that where for instance, there was a huge rainfall storm. A storm in Johannesburg in summer is a very normal event. In fact, it was so normal that people used to refer to it as government rain, because at 4 o'clock, the rain would start, when all government officials were going home, and at 5 o'clock, it would just disappear, and the skies were blue. And that was the weather of your youth. That's the way it was. The idea, for instance, of us having massive downpours to such an extent that cars are swept off roads on highways because of the intensity of the storm. Now, that's different. The storm itself is not a change, but the intensity of the storm is a change. And so that's another aspect of climate change. Climate change is predicted to increase the intensity of extreme weather events, the frequency of extreme weather events. In other words, in your lifetime, although you may see snow in Johannesburg once in your lifetime, the thing with climate change, it means that you could be seeing it twice or three times in a month. That's the kind of thing. So it's not global warming, it's climate change. And that's why we refrain from the use the word global warming, because in essence it could actually mean cooling in certain areas. The changes are very difficult to predict as well. As I said, in many instances, for the sake of national communication, we've got some top South African scientists actually looking at these changes. And one of the things has been changes in rainfall patterns, which of course is really, really important for a water-poor country. And the reality is that in some sort of situations, long records of rainfall patterns have shown a decrease in rainfall in some town. And you travel 50 kilometers down the road and there's an increase in rainfall in another town. So this is it's very difficult to generalize these sort of situations, but where we can generalize, we know that, for example, across the board, temperatures have been increasing. And with that temperature increasing, it means that we have more evaporation, which means our soil is getting drier, which means that our crops are going to have less water in the soil to grow, which means that our area of arable land is changing. The areas of desertified areas that were only cactus and succulents can grow, is going to grow. That's the kind of situation. So it's basically those are the things. The other aspect of natural disasters, because the temperature increasing, the melting of land-based ice, is basically increasing the volume of water in the seas, and that's leading to the seas increasing. As the seas get warmer, of course, they also start expanding, so that also leads to the rise in sea level. So that is another thing. And so another thing that's associated with climate change is the impacts of increased sea level and increased weather events. And this has resulted in what they call storm surges. These huge coastal storms, these massive waves that are rushing down the roads and into cities and what have you. That is a result of that kind of situation. Now this is where we're very, very careful. And I sound like a scientist here, now, because scientists always try to say, well, this is... there's a 100%, there's a 10% certainty on this. And they basically couch themselves. And I'm going to have to do it here as well. You can never point a finger and say, Hurricane Katrina was a result of climate change. Hurricane Katrina was a hurricane. The Earth has experienced hurricanes, it always does. What you can say is that hurricanes like Katrina are likely to increase in severity and intensity and frequency with climate change. So you can never say Katrina was as a result of climate change, but events like Katrina are going to happen more frequently. And that's the situation. all the other aspects of seismic activities, in other words, things that involve movement of the Earth's plates, like earthquakes, volcanoes, and tsunamis as a result of earthquakes or volcanoes, those are not, at this stage, linked to climate change in any way. There is a feeling that, for instance, well, look, if we're heating up the planet, and these seismic events must be, are we oiling the wheels of this planet's movement, for example? So there's talk about it, but there's no scientific data that links seismic activities, volcanoes, and tsunamis and earthquakes to climate change at this stage. So that's where it stands. You asked about biomass burning, and it's something that we measure as well, believe it or not, and we're pretty good at it. In fact, South Africa have come up with some very clever ways of actually measuring this stuff, not only just purely from greenhouse gas emissions, but also from an air quality perspective. We want to know how much fault fires contribute to poor air, specifically in the high fault. So we've done a whole bunch of work, and basically what we do is we analyze what we call burn scar data from satellite photographs. And so we find out exactly where the fires are happening. We look at the density of the vegetation, and we can actually predict how much is coming from there. And so it's been looked at from a scientific point of view. We measure it, and in actual fact, it's even reported in South Africa's greenhouse gas inventory how much greenhouse gas comes from biomass burning. However, it's reported there as what they call a memo item. It's not actually measured because it's burning of a renewable resource. It's grass. So it releases the carbon. But in summer and after the spring, when the grass starts growing, it basically absorbs the carbon again. So it keeps the balance. So biomass burning is fine. It's a natural source of emissions, but the same grass that when it grows again reabsorbs that carbon again. The big difference is that when you start clearing those grasslands, then of course there's an accumulation because there's no grass growing there to take the stuff anymore. And that's where it starts making a difference. So that's one of the aspects of the major aspects of climate change, which South Africa doesn't really concern itself about, and that's the aspect of deforestation. The Earth's natural capacity to absorb carbon. And the interesting fact is, and I wish I could show you this slide, if one looks at the measurement of our carbon dioxide in the air at Cape Point, you can see a movement of the graph like this, and it basically is the Earth breathing. In summer, basically, with huge amounts of growth, we're absorbing carbon. In winter, when the leaves drop, we release carbon. And so you can actually see the Earth breathing in terms of carbon. But unfortunately, that breathing is now not sustained. It's going up and up and up and up. In terms of compact fluorescent CFL, compact fluorescent lights, and even the better ones now, which is light-emitting diodes, LED lights, which are the most effective ways of looking at these things, they do make a huge difference. This is absolutely no doubt. In terms of the lighting budget, and energy budget for lighting, the conversion to CFLs and the conversion even beyond that to compact fluorescents, to light-emitting diodes, LEDs, is a dramatic change. But the unfortunate thing is that there's some side effects. The one was brought up by somebody in terms of the mercury. In terms of CFLs, it's mercury. Light-emitting diodes don't have that problem. The mercury aspect, to be honest, at this stage, I mean, we are doing a bit of a balancing act, and the mercury aspect at this stage is really quite a trivial one compared to the global warming aspect. So, but you have to deal with both. And so therefore, we have to increase our waste management around old CFLs and start extracting that mercury and then using them again. And it's just part of the waste management recycling program that is actually underway. In actual fact, if you go to Pick and Pay now, you'll see that there's, for instance, specific bins for old CFLs, and that's specifically there to extract the mercury. You ask, for instance, then, should we just ban old incandescent lights? Well, National Treasury has gone one step further and a step towards making them unattractive, is that there's basically a tax on the old incandescent light, the bulbs now. So if you buy a bulb, the old bulb, it's actually costing a lot more than it used to in the past. And it's a tax, and that tax will be increased over time. So eventually, people won't buy the old bulb because it's so expensive. So that's already happening. In terms of the questions around clean coal, and that's what came up in the public hearings, is that the argument is that coal is intrinsically dirty. It's a dirty fossil fuel, and if you burn it, it produces smoke and other pollutants and what have you. There's no such thing as clean coal. People then argue that, for instance, the closest thing to clean coal that we've got is the Sasol process, where we've taken this rock and we've converted it to a nice, shiny liquid fuel that we can burn in our cars and what have you, and you don't see huge amounts of smoke pouring out. It's still not a clean source of energy. It's a fossil fuel. Fossil fuels will always have emissions. So within that stuff, we would refrain from the use of the phrase clean coal, because there's no such thing, and it's difficult to defend that at all. So we're talking about cleaner coal, and cleaner coal really is around the conversion technologies. So in other words, the fuel itself is not being changed, but like the new power stations, for example, when they're hyper-supercritical or whatever they are, highly efficient coal-fired power stations, we call those cleaner coal for the simple reasons they have less emissions than before because they're burning far more efficiently. The other aspects of this as well is that cleaner coal comes down to a situation where they're actually doing coal washing, where they actually crush the coal and go through a process of washing where it washes out a lot of the sulfur as well, and that makes the coal cleaner. It doesn't make it clean, but cleaner. So cleaner coal refers to processes that are in place to actually reduce the emissions from coal. They're always the same. The big hope here for the cleanest coal is carbon capture and storage. Is that, for instance, if we can burn the stuff, capture the carbon, and then store it somewhere. And the idea, of course, is we just put it back underground, and we keep it underground. And hopefully it stays. That's the intention. And that would be the cleanest form of coal. But once again, we're taking a waste product and putting it underground.
Excuse me. Why do you say hopeful?
I beg your pardon?
Why do you say hopeful?
Hopefully
it stays.
Well, hopefully it does. I mean, that's the whole sort of situation. I mean, within the work that's been done, and I think the South African National Energy Research Institute and the Climate and the Carbon Capture and Storage Center are doing some excellent work. And one of the bits of work that they're doing now is, for instance, looking at mapping of areas for potential storage. And those areas of potential storage are looking specifically at areas where it will stay. So that the land, so that the rock stratum above where we're going to store is not fractured and what have you. But within the whole sort of situation, you can never guarantee that it's going to stay there. I mean, you're putting a gas underground and hoping that it'll stay there. No? So of course, we hope that it stays there. In terms of the question around the cleaner aspect about is China stockpiling coal because they actually have a better way of doing this, the reality is that burning fossil fuels, we've reached the peak of that type of technology. It's not going to get any cleaner than it is. We can start tweaking it, and we know this in long discussions with Eskom. We've reached a point now where we're kind of at a stage of the technology of coal burning where it's really is the cleanest it's going to be. And any tweak, making it slightly cleaner, it becomes so expensive as to become almost ridiculous. So within that, no. I mean, China is just going and they're just basically using any type of energy source they can. However, China is also exceptionally clever. If they're burning coal because everybody's burning coal, and there's no agreement not to burn coal, but China is already building up its renewable energy resources, and it is already, within a period of 10 years, is now the world's leading supplier of photovoltaic panels. In 10 years. When they do something, they don't do anything in small ways. I mean, we have very, very proud of going up to Darling and seeing our five little windmills sitting on the windmill there. Oh, renewable energy, fantastic. When China does it, they'll have 50,000 of those, not five. And they'll do it one shot. And when they do that, of course, it means that they develop an entire manufacturing industry around it, that they employ huge amounts of people. It becomes a massive source of income and a huge source of revenue. And they're in a position where they can do that sort of stuff, and that's the kind of thing they're doing. And the reality is that coal is going to die. Either the planet dies or coal dies. So when coal dies, China is going to be there. It's going to have all the alternatives. And what are we going to do? We're going to have to buy from them. And we're not going to have that. So within that, I mean, that's what this is around. In terms of the renewable energy stuff, I mean, let's be honest, is that life on this planet has one energy source, and it's called the sun. That's the only reason we're here, is the sun. So renewable energy isn't weak. Our technology is weak. That's what it boils down to. Life on this planet is solar powered. We just haven't really been able to harness it properly enough to actually power our lives. And in terms of the aspect of storage, for instance, example, how do we get our energy? We eat. It's purely stored sunlight. It's stored in meat. It's stored in plants. That's the storage system of nature. And that's how we have our energy. We get it from there. So in other words, in terms of trying to harness the sun's energy into lights like this, the technology that we have is that's our challenge. It's not the solar power resource is not the challenge. It's our technology that's the challenge. And that is the challenge of science. And within that sort of situation, the amount of money and research we put there is really where we should be focusing on how to actually have a sustainable life. And in terms of sustainability, that is the only sustainable option. Renewable energy, energy that comes from the sun, either through the form of wave energy or wind or other forms of, that manifests itself, is the only real sustainable form of energy. Because what we've done is coal itself is stored solar energy. It's old plants that have just been compressed over millions of years. And we thought that we could take millions and millions of years of compressed solar energy and burn it in 100 years and expect no implications. What is it doing? It's taking our climate back to when that coal was put down there in the first place. Millions and millions of years ago, before humans existed. That's what we're doing to our climate. We're putting it back to the time when coal was formed. The time of the dinosaurs. The megastorms. That kind of weather. In terms of the questions around the COP17 position, there's a discussion about it as well, but I think it must also be quite clear is that our COP17 position is slightly nuanced and more subtle than usual for a very, very obvious reason. It's because we are the hosts of COP this year. So as the COP president, we are required to start, as COP president, putting aside our national interests and having to think of the global interests. Of course, our national interests impact that whole sort of situation. But in terms of being an honest broker, as the president of the COP, we have to think as a successful COP, as a successful COP for the planet. However, that doesn't give up our sovereign right as we as South Africans to also try and find a COP outcome that also benefits South Africans. So we have, for the first time as a host, we have this balancing act. We have the overall messaging around what we want to see coming out of the COP as a global outcome. And then from the South African side is what we as South Africans would regard as a successful outcome. And I guess that's the second part of what my colleague from Energy will talk about. In terms of the renewable energy and working for energy in the rural applications as well, you know, as an activist from many years ago, the whole thing about renewable energy, the slogan was renewable energy is people's power. And that was it, because no one owns the sun. If you have a photovoltaic panel, there's no government that can say that you're not going to generate electricity because it's yours. You put it on your roof, they can't charge you for it, you pay for it, it's yours, it's your energy. And so within that sort of situation, renewable energy is also modular. It can be put anywhere. You don't have to be on a coal field, or you don't have to be near a power line. You can be anywhere, as long as you have a renewable source of energy. So for rural energization, renewable energy is already considered to be the best way of doing it. And you see this. I mean, if you start going to deep rural areas, the Eastern Cape, for example, you see far more photovoltaic panels on houses charging batteries for radios than you see power lines, for example. And that's correct, but we haven't exploited it as much as we possibly can. Then there's an element of renewable energy that we must also be very, very careful with, and it comes down to the questions around transport too, is this ghettoization of technologies. And I'll give you a real classic example of how a technology can be ghettoized. Some very, very well-meaning people decided that in Ivory Park, in Gauteng, small squatter community, they wanted security lighting, they wanted street lighting, just to improve their security. Somebody said, let's put solar street lights here. And the community said, no, we don't want solar street lights here. We want the same lights that the people in Kailami's got. The reality, of course, is that those lights in Kailami are the ones that they should have put in Ivory Park. And it should have been the rich area that got the solar power. Because by actually giving the poor the solar energy, like solar water heating only goes on poor houses, but the rich people can still use electricity for heating and what have you. You ghettoize technologies. And we're doing the same with public transport. The most effective public transport we have in the country is the minibus taxi. Let's be honest. But what is that? When people start moving out of a certain bracket, what do? The first thing they do is they buy a car and move away from the minibus taxi as quickly as they possibly can. We have ghettoized public transport to an extent that public transport is the transport of the poor. Luckily, things are changing. The poor are never going to afford a Gautrain ticket. But Gautrain has to be a sort of situation where somebody aspires to this. I want to catch that train. Personally, that's desperately what I'm looking for. I'm looking to catch Gautrain. It's a form of public transport. Within this sort of situation, the whole aspect around transport is so incredibly important. In the white paper, within the green paper, we have a comment, for instance, we have to look at this thing called passenger modal shift, moving people out of their private cars into public transport. And that is not going to be into minibus taxis. That is going to be into minibus taxis, into bus rapid transit systems, into fast rail, into what have you, but basically into mass transit system that are good for the economy, good for the people. It improves our efficiency as a nation, and it reduces our greenhouse gas emissions dramatically. That's where we have to go. And I think the Department of Transport suddenly realized this is the way of the future, this is the way we have to go. Industry itself says we're sick and tired of hearing government saying we have to move from road to rail for freight. That's to say, we've been wanting to do this for years, but the rail system is so terrible that we can't do it. So there's a massive challenge for us as well, is to actually start looking at our rail system and actually improving it. Because to be honest, rail is one of the most effective forms of climate-friendly transport you can get. It's mass transport. It's very, very good. The question around this developed nation story, it is true that on average, we must have a look at a sort of situation where, for instance, the developed nations have driven their economies through fossil fuels. And in the process of doing so, are largely responsible for the amount of carbon dioxide that we have in the air that is causing climate change. Developing countries have had little impact. In terms of the African situation, I mean, Africa as a continent has only contributed 2% to greenhouse gas emissions. And yet Africa is probably one of the most impacted by climate change. The global injustice of that is just so scary as to be tragic. Basically what is happening is that, and I'm going to put this very bluntly, Chair, the US, for example, has profited by massive fossil fuel use, and now Africans are going to pay for that. That's what it boils down to. They're going to pay for it with their lives through reductions in water, massive increases in food insecurity, huge amounts of new disease burdens, and what have you. And so, of course, there's a real, real anger around that injustice. However, we as South Africa are not innocent victims. We've been burning fossil fuels throughout our development. If one looks at South Africa's emissions of that 2% that Africa provides to the global contribution to greenhouse gases, we're responsible for 50% of that. There was a certain level of pride from our negotiating team coming back from Bonn this last weekend, who said, thank God, Nigeria has knocked South Africa off the top emitter of the African list. So what I'm saying is that we're not victims here. We have, so in this sort of situation, our profile is very much like a developed country emissions profile. So we cannot hide behind the developing nation thing when it comes down to our mitigation. We have to actually start owning up to our responsibilities. Although, let me be honest, we will continuously hide behind this sort of situations. And when it comes to our negotiating position, as you will hear, we will still say that we're a victim here. We need carbon space. We need to grow. The point that was made about lights, street lights on during the day and what have you. I mean, one of the things we learned from the long-term mitigation scenario process was simply this, that technological solutions only take us to a certain level. It's behavioral change. It's the whole situation that this is unacceptable, that this must change, that you actually see it, this is very odd. 1,000 people reported, not one person thinks, we shouldn't really be doing this. The way we think, the way we design buildings, the point around compact fluorescent lights, LEDs as well, my house has now been completely converted to light-emitting diodes. I've reduced my emissions quite dramatically from my house. But my wife tells me, Peter, we live in darkness. And the reason is because what I've done is I've taken an old light fitting, I've just put a new light bulb into it, which of course is not the same brightness, which means we have to start redesigning the way we light the areas. Well, we're not doing that yet, but we will have to do that. We can't just think we can do a technological fix by just changing a light bulb and that's going to make a difference. There are new things and new ways we have to start doing these things. Let me give you an example of something that just drives me absolutely insane. And I must apologize to the women, is that this only men will know this. Can you imagine? Now, women just listen to this because the insanity is just amazing. Can you imagine taking South Africa's most precious resource, which is water? We then take our coal-based energy and we freeze that water into ice. Then we take that ice and we put it in a urinal. Now, gentlemen, you've seen this. Why on earth would we do something as insane as that? In a urinal, so we can pee on it. We take our most precious resource, we freeze it with energy, and then we pee on it. Why on earth would we do a thing like this? If you go into hotels, you see this. If you go into restaurants, you see this. If you go into shopping malls, you see this. Why we do this, I have no idea. But it is absolutely bizarre. And this is what it comes down to, the behavioral change. We have to start thinking about what we're doing. And so within that, there's a whole element of the work we do must be around outreach. It's not just the quick fix around tech. There is no silver bullet. It's no, for instance, by saying, let's all go nuclear, it's not going to solve the problem. Let's go completely renewable, it's not going to solve the problem. It's every single aspect. We have to start looking at energy in a completely different way. The storage of electricity. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, we store sunlight all the time. And the planet has been doing it effectively for billions of years. There's some very interesting ways about it. So it's not just the battery. One of the aspects, and I'm going to come back to another point that you made around electric vehicles. If we all had electric vehicles, we would have a mobile storage system. Because we would charge our vehicles depending when the sun shines. And we would use our vehicles when the sun's not shining. So basically what we'd be doing is we'd be storing renewable energy remotely. It wouldn't cost a cent because everybody would be doing it normally, naturally. But it's a new way of thinking that, for instance, not do we have this huge pump storage scheme or this massive hydrogen fuel cell or this massive battery. We have millions of batteries. We have 50 million batteries storing electricity around the country. So that's also the kind of thinking that we do. Climate change challenges us to think completely business unusual. The game changes. The climate changes, the game changes. And our way that we have to respond to it must change dramatically as well. To be honest, Chair, I mean, this is an exceptionally exciting time. I mean, I can only speak with passion, not because I'm scared completely about it, which I am, but I'm also enthused by the potential it can actually do for the nation. When do we start implementing? We are implementing. We're not going fast enough, but we are. The IRP, for example, is a real step in the right direction. It's been a sea change in the way that we've planned electricity. The amount of renewable energy that we now have in the Integrated Resource Plan is a dramatic change from the past. And that is already the right step in the right direction. It's the kind of signal that is required to say, this is not business as usual. This is not just a model or a hobby. This is the real deal. We're actually starting to make a change. As I said, I don't think it's enough, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. The Integrated, the Industrial Plan of Action as well, also an entire section on green economy and looking at building up new green industries and what have you. Also, well, it should be mainstream throughout the IPAC, but already it's a step in the right direction. So implementation is starting. As usual, it's slow and perhaps not at the pace that we'd like to see it, but it's happening. What we need to do is accelerate it and get that pace moving. I've talked about transport and EV. The question of nuclear, I mean, government has a policy on this, and the Department of Energy has a policy, and we have a nuclear path. I mean, I'm not going to make a comment on that. What I accept to say, for instance, that in terms of whether nuclear is a better, from a climate change perspective, than coal, purely from emissions, it is absolutely correct. The emissions from nuclear are far, far less than coal. Institutional arrangements and accountability. I mean, I think this is important. One of the things, and I must be honest, is that one of the criticisms of the Green Paper has been the sort of situation is that there's a shopping list of good ideas. Do we want a policy that actually has a shopping list of ideas, or do we want a policy that shows us the right direction and gives us the process of making sure that these ideas actually happen? And that new ideas are actually added continuously. And I think that's the way the White Paper is going to go. So I think there may be some disappointment that the White Paper is not going to have the detailed interventions around specific aspects of things that people really want to see. But hopefully it'll have a process that actually makes it easier and actually starts tying the level of accountability much, much clearer to where it should be. The review of the renewable policy, that's my Department of Energy colleague. Solar water heating program is the same. We've not specifically mentioned it, but as I said, this the idea in the white paper is that we're not going to mention these things. The white paper is probably going to talk into the implementation thing, when do we implement. The white paper is probably going to go into a process for how we transition, but it's not going to say we're only going to start working in 10 years' time. The idea now is to actually have a whole series of quite clearly defined flagship projects that must happen now. While we're doing further planning to get to find out where we need to go, there must be things that happen now. Stuff that are no-brainers, we know that must happen. The greening of Parliament. Since the last time we spoke in terms of the parliamentary hearings, and I promised the chair of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee that I would see if I could find some support for Parliament to look at greening, I have done so and I've been successful. Chair, the German Parliament is one of the greenest parliaments in the world. And I don't know if you've visited the Bundestag in Berlin, but it is quite a remarkable building. And I have...
Nürstien.
I beg your pardon?
Nürstien.
It is quite a remarkable building. And I, through the German government as well, I've asked to see if there's a potential linkage with their parliament around looking at greening. And there's a real chance. And they're very, very keen. They're very, very interested. And in fact, GIZ, the people who look after the money, are very, very keen to meet the parliamentary committee that is looking after greening. And so I understand it's you. So if that is the case, you will have a contact detail by the end of this meeting, and they will phone you before the end of today. And there is a real chance that you can actually put together an entire audit process with other stuff as well. On the aspect of safety in mines, to be honest, ma'am, with extreme weather events, I'd rather be down a mine, to be honest. We've never thought of that. I mean, we've talked about things like, for instance, changes in weather patterns and how they could actually impact on mines as well. But it's not seen as a dramatic implication at this stage. I mean, we could be wrong, but as far as we're concerned, it's not been given a massive priority. The biggest threat to the mines, of course, would be the closure of the mines. I mean, if no one wants to use coal, then, of course, then there's no reason for coal mines. And that's always been a point. I mean, in one of the parliamentary hearings we had, was a question was posed to me for saying, but if we have 200 years of coal in the ground, we're going to mine it. The reality is that we don't mine something because it's in the ground. We mine it because somebody wants it. And if no one wants it, then we don't mine it. So the mining industry is not based on the size of the resource, but it's on the demand for that resource. So the globe will have to move away from carbon. So we have to start facing the facts, and we have to start looking at new opportunities for the people that are involved in these sort of situations. Storage of solar I've spoken about. Energy intensity. But let me not be glib about the storage of solar as well. There are, in terms of our current thinking, there must be ways of doing proper storage as well. In terms of the Department of Energy's plan and the reefer tariffs and what have you, and Eskom's plan around concentrated solar, one of the things they've been looking at is this whole sort of situation of salt storage, where basically electricity that is produced during the day under good sunlight conditions melts salt. And then at night, basically the salt is left to crystallize again and release its energy again, and that's a kind of battery. And that's a massive battery. And that is already being looked at in the national fact in terms of my understanding of Eskom's concentrated solar power plant. That's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to build this huge battery to store this stuff. And basically give it the same availability in terms of electricity, much the same as a power station, which is fantastic. Energy intensity is the structure of our economy and how our economy evolves. I mean, we can't believe that our economy just grows completely organically. As governments, we shape the way our economy evolves, and we have shaped the structure of this economy. There's no doubt. I mean, the military mining complex has been a political structuring of our economy. That's how we're doing it. So therefore, we have the power to actually change that. And that's where the challenge lies, is we have to actually steer this economy in a particular direction that we are going to be proud of and that we believe sustains our lives and our people. So within that sort of evolution, that's the important aspect. So with that in that, I mean, we have to start looking at, exactly as you say, changes in our processes and the way that we produce products. And also the way that we think as well. One of the aspects, for example, is the cement industry always comes to me and says, Peter, because the making of cement creates greenhouse gases, there's nothing we can do. just the very, there's no ways that you can make cement without creating greenhouse gases. That's not an excuse. The cement industry is going to have to think about what they do about those greenhouse gases. Either they do carbon capture and storage, or suddenly the cement industry is going to have to become the biggest forestry industry as well. They're going to have to start growing trees to offset the carbon they emit. And so there's no real excuse. Within this sort of situation, it's a completely new thinking, and you're already starting to see this in the carbon footprinting idea, reducing our carbon footprinting. People are starting to audit carbon the same way as they audit their money. And that is the correct thing to do under these circumstances. Then the little final question was, in order to look at the new technologies, we need international assistance. At an an Africa Institute meeting, somebody stood up in the audience and said, after somebody else said, we need, you know, in terms of our commitments and what have you, the US must be able to provide us with windmills and these sort of situations and what have you. And somebody stood up in the audience and said, this is the African century. In order to make this the African century, are we going to lead by following? Are we going to bankroll the African century from loans from the US? And the answer has to be no. If this is the African century, it has to be none but ourselves that do this. And the reality is that if we can start looking at proper development paths and what have you, we're not a poverty-stricken country. We have a country that has poverty dramatically. But we're in a situation where we have amazing technologies. We have innovation. We have people and good science. There are things that we can do. So within that sort of situation, I think the challenge really lies with us trying to lead. And already I'm sitting in a situation where at the Eastern Cape Climate Change Conference 2 weeks ago, I had people queuing up with pamphlets on South African wind turbines, completely locally designed, completely manufactured. The Joule vehicle was there on exhibition. It was a real, the Joule vehicle, the electric vehicle, is an eye-opener, because that's a real good old-fashioned swords to plowshares type thing that is akin to our getting rid of our nuclear weapons. Basically, it was a bunch of scientists who were involved in the South African weapons manufacture for many, many years, decided that instead of actually making guns that kill people, why don't they make cars that actually help people? So the Joule is made by a whole bunch of scientists that used to make weapons and are now making electric vehicles. And hopefully, when they start going commercial in the next few years, and hopefully government supports by making our fleets electric and what have you, we suddenly have created, we have basically utilized South Africans' can-do expertise, our technology expertise, and start greening our fleet through locally manufactured cars. South Africa hasn't manufactured cars en masse for years now. But there's a real chance for us to do this. And, Chair, I'm going to stop at this stage.
Thank you very much, Mr. Francis. Honourable members, I'm very sorry to have had tea at 11. But I'm sure we'll all agree there was no way I could interrupt such a brilliant response. Before we get further inputs, can you just grab our cups of tea and come back? Include Lex Stretch a little bit as well. Thank you for now.
Thank you. The other one is the official one for the cardinal.
We can get under any of the hands.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, honorable members, let's resume.
We're still getting the responses from the Department of Environment and Water Affairs, or Water and Environmental Affairs. Over to you, gentlemen.
Just on the question of implementation, I think there was a question asked, you know, when do we start implementing, what are the restrictions, what are the challenges, and in the context of solar water heating, solar photovoltaic, and all of that, you know, the big question is, what is happening and what's not happening. Now, in terms of the integrated resource plan on electricity, there's a provision of 42% renewable energy generation by 2030. And the big question is that, you know, are we going to meet the target and how are we going to do it? And some of the key challenges are in the areas of the institutions that need to deliver on that, the regulatory environment that must deliver on that, and the financing mechanisms that must do that as well. And so, you know, in those three areas, we face major challenges currently. So on financing, the big question is, how do we finance all of this? We've got 8,400 megawatts of solar PV. There's about 8,400 megawatts of wind energy and so forth. And where is the money going to come from? Now, we've hit some serious roadblocks in terms of the regulatory environment that was supposed to have enabled all of this to happen. and this was a so-called renewable energy feed-in tariff, which was announced about 2.5 years ago. But to date, we haven't delivered a single megawatt. And for us, I mean, in terms of delivering on the climate imperative, that was going to be a significant step forward for us to meet our climate targets. Because the way the RP is designed is that we've imposed a climate constraint on the electricity sector, that where we've capped emissions. And the basis of that is that there'll be more renewable energy, you know, and in terms of reducing emissions. So the regulatory environment that was supposed to have delivered on this, we are facing some major problems. So you've seen the media reports on the refit last week, and basically we've done a 180 degree turn. And what was supposed to have been envisaged in terms of a price, a fixed price, is now no more a fixed price. It's now going to be a competitive bid. So our engagement with industry is in the context of a lot of them are really packing up the bags and going home now, going back, because there's no more the incentive. So it is in the context of what will be the incentives. And the same applies to things like solar water heaters, which is largely unaffordable to the masses in South Africa. It's extremely expensive for an ordinary person to put up the solar geyser at his house. And what happened there as well, when Eskom announced the subsidy, what the suppliers did was that they took the subsidy and put it on top of the price that they were selling it and started selling at a higher price. And they just, you know, cashed in again there. So I think there needs to be some serious work in those three areas of how we finance, what will be the incentives, what's going to be the enabling regulatory environment to enable South Africa to really leapfrog and make this dramatic kind of improvement in our emissions profile. And then the third issue is in the area of the institutional arrangements. And, you know, we've had a utility that's been dominating the sector for a long time, and a lot of talk around how to restructure Eskom in terms of, you know, making it more independent, having an independent systems operator, and there's been an independent systems and market operator bill that's been around for a while. And in terms of the new institutions that must deliver on independency and transparency, that's going to be a talk for a few years before we start getting the proper institutions in place. So to date, we faced major challenges in these areas around power purchase agreements, around prices, around tariffs, around incentives. And our appeal also to the committee is that, you know, we need to work together with the departments concerned, with Treasury, Eskom, NERSA, Department of Energy, and so forth, to try and unblock all these barriers, because it's not working, it's not helping us. You know, you want us to make sure that the climate imperative is mainstreamed and streamlined across all the sectors. This thing of who's going to be knocking the heads, you know. We have to really understand how is this going to be implemented. So the implementation framework is going to be in these three areas. And, you know, it's going to be a major challenge for the next couple of years. So one of the big things we've lost now is the whole refit story, and we need to find out ways of how do we re-energize, excuse the pun there, but how do we create more assurance now in the sectors amongst IPPs. And government is working on the solar park initiative, and there's some positive elements in that regard. But you know, there's going to be some serious work that government has to do to unlock and unblock major barriers in these areas. And then in terms of technology, I was telling you that, you know, on batteries and so forth, you know, we're talking about batteries. There's been a lot of work being done recently by the CSR and the Innovation Hub in terms of, you know, latest technologies on batteries. And I was quite surprised. They showed me a picture of a Formula One racing car that's running entirely on an electric battery, reaching speeds of over 200 kilometers an hour just off an electric battery. And I was absolutely surprised. and it's happened. The technology is South African and it's developed here. So, you know, we have to wait and see what's going to come of that in years to come. And in terms of storage problems as well, just to share with you, what happens in terms of the RP and the way we measure reserve margin. So this is the big thing of energy security and reserve margin and when the lights go out and when does load shedding start. What has been done is that you'll see in the RP there's a big increase in the number of what we call closed cycle gas turbines. So what happens is that they bring on a lot of renewable energy, but at the same time it must be balanced. When there's no sun and when there's no wind, how do you ensure that there's still, you know, energy in the system? So they bring on a lot of what is called closed cycle gas turbines. I think you've got two here in the Western Cape, the open cycle gas turbines that run on diesel, which is very, very expensive and very polluting. And the idea of closed cycle gas turbines is to bring in what is known as liquefied natural gas to make sure that, you know, you balance the system. Now, there are questions about these as well. But the big story is that we, as if I can say, the renewable energy sector or the green side of things, is that we have a window of opportunity. Before the next revision of the RP, we've got to demonstrate to the country and to ourselves, I suppose, and to the public, that indeed we can deliver on renewable energy. Now, if it's not the case, and in a few years' time we do the revisions, we go through these three areas of the regulatory, finance, and institutional aspects, and we ask ourselves, have we made progress in these areas? What will happen then is that the RPO will be revised and say, no, in the last 5 years we haven't delivered a single megawatt of renewable energy. Maybe renewable energy is not the way of the future. Maybe we must go back to coal and back to nuclear. And that's exactly what's going to happen if we don't deliver in the next couple of years, because the RPO will be revised. We have to make some major decisions in the period of 2022 onwards, when a lot of our coal power stations will reach the end of their life and a lot of them will come offline. What are we going to replace it with? It's either nuclear, renewables, if we can prove that we can deliver on scale, or the country will have to go back on coal just because of energy security reasons. And that's the argument that will be used at the time. But those decisions, for instance, on the nuclear fleet program, that decision has to be made in the next year, because there's a 10-year lead time on a nuclear power station. And our critical period is in the period of 2022 onwards, where we have to seriously think of how we replace all of the energy with other sources. So that kind of challenge, I think I'm going to leave to you. I don't know if Mukhari wants to say something.
Okay, thanks, Chair. I just want to respond, to add to some of the issues that have been raised here. I think, as South Africans, we need to be realistic in terms of how we are approaching the issue of coal versus the renewable energy sector. It's a fact that as South Africans, we cannot overnight, shut down on the coal issue. It's where we're coming from. It's a reality that we have to face. The approval of the integrated resource plan has demonstrated the commitment in terms of moving towards diversification or, the energy mix. The coal issue, as much as we would want to phase it out, we still need to address issues on the ground in terms of, realities. For example, the issue around, the renewable energy scaling up, it's not something that you would do like as in today, as you anticipate, as in now, because there is a funding aspect that is required. The issue of technology, we're talking about manufacturing sectors, in terms of the components that are required. So it needs to be a phased out approach in terms of how do we get to the point of saying now we are in a position, or we are confident that we are in a position to phase out, the coal. So I would just want to indicate that as much as we want to deal away with coal, we need to be realistic. Coal is there. It cannot be phased out tonight, but like the integrated resource plan is getting us there. The second point that I would want to make is, relating to the refit. yes, we acknowledge that there have been delays. If you look at, the NERSA technology approval, the RFID, when was it approved? I mean, that was in 2009, March and October, respectively, in terms of the technologies that need to be, taken into account. And early in 2010, there was a process in terms of, the selection criteria. And, I would indicate that based on, the outcome, it wasn't satisfactory in terms of, how the regulatory framework has to comply or, satisfy the whole process. It would be inappropriate just to implement for the sake of saying South Africa has, implemented the RFID without having complied with our, legislative framework. And it's not only the Department of Energy, that is in this process. The other key departments like National Treasury, DPE, are part of this process in terms of finalizing the RFID process. You would have, you have noted in the Minister of Energy's budget vote speech that we're still committed in terms of making sure that we implement the RFID as soon as possible. And I would reiterate and emphasize the point that the department is committed and we need to make sure that regulatory, factors that need to be taken into account are factored in before the implementation process, starts. And I would highlight the point that it shouldn't create fear in terms of saying the IPPs are now paying bets. I would differ with my colleagues. There could be some dissatisfaction in terms of, the delays or how the matter has been handled. But there is so much, IPPs that are interested in investing in South Africa. And we're still looking forward in terms of, getting them on board. You would realize that, in terms of getting IPPs on board, there is a parallel process in terms of the independent power producers like the ISMOBI, which the department is, taking forward in making sure that, there is a fair playground. We're all acknowledging that, all along, ESCOM has been monopolizing, the sector. So to get IPPs on board, you need to make sure that the necessary institutional arrangements are also on board. The ISMOBIL is looking at that. And like I would say, we would definitely work as a collective, and if maybe there are any fears from Department of Environmental Affairs, we'll get on board and work on, moving forward. And you would realize that this is an emerging sector. As much as the RFID has been implemented, but there are also hints, in terms of its failures in other countries. We wouldn't want to implement for the sake of implementing, not looking at, a holistic view in terms of contextualizing the situation, to the country. Definitely, as a country, I think we are committed to making sure that renewable energy scaling up is a way to go. In relation to, there was a question in terms of why is South Africa not moving towards enforcing the LEDs. I would indicate that as well, it's not only a matter relating to Department of Energy. The department has been engaging with Department of Trade and Industry to make sure that as we phase out inefficient technologies, we're not compromising the trade issues as well as our job creation nature. There have been several workshops, in particular to the phasing out of incandescent light. And like that process is well underway, and I hope that soon we may even come to the portfolio committee and brief in detail on what are the aspects that could be delaying the process or what are the issues that we're still engaging in. Because we cannot kill the market overnight, but it's something that we're taking into cognizance that we need to move towards the LEDs. But like the incandescent light, it's there. People, over time, if we were to go backward in terms of, the cost price for the incandescent lights as well as the LEDs, when they came in, the LEDs were a bit expensive. Even if you do the rollout, when people, when it back, they go back to the incandescent light because of, the status of, the diverse nature of, our population. Not everybody would be affording that. But as we roll out the LEDs, with time, the price would, I mean, definitely go down. And like by introducing the legislation that says we are now cutting down on the incandescent line, I mean, it would be a phased approach rather than an overnight thing. Also, there was a caution in terms of the cleaner fuels and the cleaner coal technology. As much as, I mean, coal is polluting, what we are saying is we need to concentrate on the cleaner coal technology, the technologies that would assist in terms of reducing the emission coming out of coal. So basically, that's the cleaner aspect of, I mean, why we would call the cleaner part of it. And I would even indicate to the committee, when it comes to the issue of the carbon capture storage, South Africa is doing some work around that, because we're acknowledging that it is still, I mean, a new technology, and research is required in line with that. The department, together with Sasol and the UK government and Australia, have been engaging in terms of the research across the country, which I believe we need to come as well and brief, I mean, the portfolio committee on what has transpired so far, because you would realize that, I mean, the carbon capture storage atlas was released last year in August. And we're happy to share that information. And it's, I mean, a technology that we are supporting as a country, but we still say we need to go in depth in terms of how in South Africa can it be implemented. And some pilot projects have already started, which are, I mean, donor funded, including what the country is looking at. And from my side, that would be the input that would give on the white paper side. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We should have got another presentation, but I think up to now this has been quite helpful. My instinctive reaction to the last input is that I'm sure honorable members will agree that we need to explore some interministerial briefing on energy. You know, once it sends, you know, I would put it mildly, some fragmented approach between departments. I'm sure it's our duty to ensure that we have coherence. I'd like to see nods of heads shaking. I don't know whether I'm the only one who speaks that up between the two departments. And it's not helpful, because here we're talking about energy, isn't it? We're not talking about departments, we're talking about energy, and we expect from the executive a coherent and coordinated, you know, approach. And I'm sure I can safely say that we're working pretty hard to ensure that within this term we get a presentation on the ESCOM deal, and we'll obviously take up the issue of the role of the IPPs and the independent, what do you call it, ISOs. With regard to refit, I really would like to ensure that we apply our minds on that. Please give me some time to look a little bit deeper into that, because I've already been approached with a lot of uneasiness on that. I think the bottom line is that we need certainty on it. I'm not going to be prescriptive, neither, I hope, but we need certainty on it, because what comes out in the media, what has been presented to me as the chair is some form of lobbying, whatever. I mean, the only conclusion I can draw is there's lack of certainty, to put mildly, and really the executive, you know, from whichever side or from whichever state entity, we have to ensure, and in fact, not even to ensure, we have to insist on that. And honorable members, I'm sure very, very soon we need to at least address on that, because the paradigm shift from fossil based to alternative energy sources, amongst other things, it will definitely be propelled by refit and other instruments that we are introducing. Now, once one of these strategic instruments starts showing signs of working, we definitely have to intervene. It's not just a matter of making comments. We just have to intervene. believe you me. So that's the comment from one side. Respecting time, I would like just to make a comments and include a link to questions as well. When Mr. Luki started his input, which was very good, I sense that there was a lot of work that has been done as far back as 2004. The question I had is that what role has Parliament been doing throughout, in particular both houses and up to the level of the emergence of the Portfolio Committee for Energy? Of course, we have to conduct oversight, but sometimes it's helpful if my question can be loaded to be observers, because to be exposed to such intricate and complex issues at the tail end is more disempowering than being helpful, because then the question arises, to what extent can we conduct quality oversight if we are going to be highly reactive, if we are going to just to pick up stuff at the end. And I still plead that if we could get just a summary of the public hearings, because as I said, just the one day I attended, very, very interesting things were presented, particularly by the public. By the public, particularly civil society, of, you know, organizations. And whilst we are here, you know, one of the things I just would like to take advantage and talk about is the regionalization strategy, because climate change knows no boundaries. You know, the character and the extent to which, you know, climate change is handled at a regional and even continental level is very fundamental, because we can have a brilliant policy and just a crude example or an extreme. What if country X, just next to us, you know, goes to the extreme and pollutes, or just, you know, doesn't move in a millimeter, you know, how good is our good policy and programs? So it would be helpful at some stage that we look at that, the issue of, you know, regionalization. That's fine, thanks. I saw some hands. Yeah, honorable members. Let's just go through quick, so that we can move over to the Department of Energy. Thank you. There is now Honorable Kreiling and Wells. Is that all? Okay, just two hands. Thank you.
Chairman, last question for planning. That's a thing that is of planning. The issue of the risk of bidding, how far is that and when is it coming to us? That is the first question. The second is the planning question of the process. The other question is, this incandescent bill, incandescent lights, do you need legislation? I don't believe so. In my view, the issue that people must get lights, then to change that look to another look, I don't think we need the legislation. But I keep trying to see whether we need that to change to change those goals. And the last question is, Chairman, we are serious about government duties being great. Now, in this department, who are creating these duties? So that we can be able to target that particular ministry in leading matters. Because we are serious about it. We can't share the message to say where we can't see.
That is love. Leading by example.
Yes.
Kalimu.
Thank you, Chair. It does warrant a far bigger discussion, but I think that your points are right around the refit. Or, in fact, it's not going to be a refit anymore. I mean, essentially, that's what we've moved to. I think my points around this, though, is that you know, how can we have a situation where we only work out that we're running into legal problems 2.5 years down the line with the refit? You know, the biggest problem with the renewable energy sector, and this is worldwide, and I've spoken to many players in it, is they want policy certainty. So how can we come up with the refit initially and 2.5 years down the line work out that we're running into legal problems and that we have to change the whole process now? This is creating a very, very bad signal to the market at the moment in terms of how we do this. And my point around this, though, is that, you know, when it comes to building coal-fired power stations and things like that, we don't run into these problems. We find the money. We find the 125 billion rand and we go and build Mazupi and we make sure we get this thing built. When it comes to installing solar water heaters and meeting the 1 million target, we don't put enough funds towards this. NERSA doesn't give enough funds. When it comes towards IPPs, we create policy uncertainty by announcing a refit and then changing the thing 2.5 years later. What I'm saying is we have to get our act together on this if we're going to truly march forward in terms of a carbon constrained future. And, you know, what I've seen at the moment is us meddling around and not coming up with the right certainty and the right signals to the market so that we can get this thing properly working. And I think that this is something we really have to take up. I brought it up in my budget vote speech. I suspected this was coming, and this is exactly what's happened now. And we really need to deal with this, I think, as a committee.
Okay. On the issue of the Eastmobile, I cannot give the exact date, but like we can work with the committee secretariat in confirming when can the department come and present, because I'm not dealing directly with it. It's within the electricity section. But like the department will come and present. In terms of the date, it's, I mean, the logistics that can be worked around. On the issue of the incandescent line, I mean, it's not something that we can, as a department, take a unilateral decision without engaging in the sector. Because as we speak, I mean, the incandescent lights are manufactured. So we need to engage the sector, including these other key departments that are playing within that space. Like, for example, as I indicated, that we're engaging with Department of Trade and Industry to make sure that, I mean, all the necessary processes are followed before, whether ultimately it's legislated or even coming up with the implementation plan, to make sure that as much as we're marching forward, we're not compromising any of, I mean, even the end users as well as the processes themselves. Because we are currently talking about, I mean, job creation, we need to take that into account as to how do we make sure that ultimately all, I mean, the stakeholders are, I mean, satisfied. It should be a collective decision rather than imposing. Thanks. And on the issue of refit, I do acknowledge the delays. I'm still saying in terms of the refit, the department would come and present in detail in terms of, I mean, how the challenges cropped in and like how we addressing the whole process. But like commitment in terms of scaling up renewable energy, it's still there. That's the way to go.
No, Honourable Lady, it doesn't mean that we're satisfied. Let's give them the benefit of doubt, yeah. Look, we'll have to work around the program and see when we can fit them in, because I'm still left to be honest and indicate my uneasiness, you know. They say in the language, I was caught a little bit off guard, you know, because we're moving with the, you know, some good inspiration, seeing that refit. Now all we need is to propel it, to assist it, to support it. Then all of a sudden, this is what comes. So we'll play around with the program and work on that. In terms of Eastmobile and Elislaw, the budget votes messed us up, if I can use that. We already, if you remember, we had it fitted somewhere. Now everything, you know, fell apart. We're still working very hard to see if we can even get a special day just for a briefing for startups, you know. So, definitely the DG and others, by now they may have received. I think we're still trying to get approval for a special day from the Speaker's office, and then we'll come back and negotiate, because the initial stage is just to get a briefing even before it gets into the system. And because of its complexity and size, you know, we're not going to wait until it formally gets into
the parliament system, just to get familiarized with it, to get our researchers, you know, starting to pick up certain issues for our attention and all of that. We'll just set the ball rolling. Rest assured on that. We're working on it. Yes, this one.
Sir, you have not answered the question as to the cleaning of the government buildings is responsible. There are many potential problems public works, energy, environment, trade and industry, all of this. Now, what we are asking is to say, as Parliament, we will always be talking about clean energy, energy savings, and all of that. And government, cabinet, will always be producing to us that injection as well. Before we say to the public, do this, we must be seen to do it. And I don't mean to take anything away from it. Instead, we take it. It is in the interest of Christ that we engage in energy and in the human energy process. Now, we also really hear that we're going to talk generally to government, or we are going to be able to say Department of Public Works, or we're going to say Department of Energy, what is this energy? Or we're going to say, because business will have to be manufactured. Trade and investment must go to the next first, to the investment before we can be able to do that. Where are we? What our wish is to say, when we get into consolidating, we must be able to say, in South Africa, all government businesses are energy. We must be able to say that. But if we are going to go, the rules there for every little thing we must do. We must consult with everybody in this country to say we want to take our respect and keep our clean. Then something is wrong. We will not be able to discuss that in ourselves.
Once again, let us love, lead by example. Can you turn it around instead of asking a question and say, one, we as Parliament, from now onwards, we need to move with speed in our cleaning initiatives. Two, through the Speaker's office, we should ensure that the executive is also likewise leading by example. Not just one department, but the whole executive together with its parastatals. Unless you still want to say something. Because it's a matter of action, not even asking or consulting. Fine. I'm sure the Secretary has nicely recorded that, so that we can follow it. Mr. Luki, you wanted to say something before we close.
Chair, I just wanted to respond to two of the questions that you put forward that I don't think Bruno asked. The one was the regional aspect of things. And to basically support your position there, I mean, this, the regional aspect of climate change response is dramatically important. And your examples are quite correct. I mean, for instance, if we work out climate change response policy and increase our capacity for emergency response, but our neighbours don't, we're going to have the wholesome situations of environmental refugees. And we've already seen this. I mean, in 2000, we were able to respond because of an early warning system to floods. And we were then able to provide our neighbours in Mozambique with some flood relief and what have you. And so we have to think of this as a regional thing, is that climate change is not going to impact one country. But as you said, there are no boundaries in this situation. So the regional aspects of policy are definitely ones that we're going to be taking into account. In terms of the question around the public hearings, there is actually a public hearings report, and we will share that with you. I'll make sure that the parliamentary personnel actually make sure that you get the parliamentary hearings report. Chair, on your comment around potentially differences of opinion between departments, there are none. As far as energy is concerned, the Department of Energy is the expert on our energy future. From our side, from the environmental side, of course, we have a specific interest in renewable energy for a number of reasons. And of course, we will always sort of fight that battle. But as far as, you know, sort of coherence of the government's position is concerned, what we do is we work with the Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy comes through these things. And of course, hopefully, we are in coherence. But of course, throughout the entire process, there are, of course, links, and I think it's understandable. But if you got the impression that there's actually conflicts in positions between the departments, that is just absolutely not true.
A little bit convincing for now, but we'll keep a hawk's eye, if you don't mind. A real hawk's eye. Honorable members, I think we need to move to energy. Thanks very much. With just one closing remark, but once again, let's not forget, unless we really forget. We may talk about climate change, rainforests, global warming, changes in weather, storms and things. At the end of the day, it's about ensuring that we have a paradigm shift on our patterns of production and consumption. And at the end of the day, it's all about development. And I'm sure as the whole thing unfolds, we'll keep on referring to my preaching, if it's a good preaching. Because no matter how much technical terms you put in, at the end of the day, if you say agriculture, if you say that, you know, you pick up your small farmers or your villagers, all they'll talk is about how it impacts on their livelihoods. And that's patterns of production and consumption. And that's development. And I'm saying this because that's one of the dangers I've observed, particularly in your COP 16, 15, 17 and stuff. There's the tendency to just talk about technical issues as if at the core of it is not development. Thank you very much. Can you move over to the Department of Energy now? Tell us, see, what nice things are you going to do in COP 17?
Okay, thanks,
Chair.
I will just briefly take you through, what the presentation is all about. The second slide, it's just the outline of the presentation on what the key focus will be. If we move on to the third slide, on the overview for climate change, I thought it would be appropriate, to go back a little bit and focus on, what transpired even in other COPs before we even talk about, COP 17. The objective, of the UNFCCC convention is to protect the climate system for present and future generations by stabilizing greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere. All what the white paper is trying to address. And you would recall that, based on this, there were two subsidiary bodies, which one was established in 2005, which is the Ad Hoc Working Group on Further Commitment for Annex 1 parties under Kyoto Protocol to negotiate binding agreement post-2012 emissions target. And during the COP13 in Bali in 2007, the UNFCCC negotiation process assigned to a new subsidiary body, which is the Ad Hoc Working Group on Long-Term Cooperative Active, expected to complete its work in 2009. And present the outcome of its work to the Conference of Parties for Adoption at the 15th session leading to the Bali Action Plan. And therefore, it decided to launch a comprehensive process to enable the full, effective, sustained implementation of the convention through long-term cooperative action up to and beyond 2012. And the COP that we're referring to, that was the Copenhagen, where it was expected that there would be a full detail in terms of, the full agreement on the convention. And if we go back again on the Bali Action Plan, actually it was outlining the long-term global goal for emission reduction, the enhanced national and international mitigation action.
That's on that, because we're still going to get quite an exposure of climate change and its history. I would plead if you could move a little bit faster towards, what exactly is energy going to be doing for COP 17?
Oh, okay. Yeah, basically the other slides are just wrapping up on, what the Cancun Agreement is, where are we with, the COP 17 negotiations. Okay. Yeah, the Mexican team, with the United Nations Secretariat and the South African team led by Minister Maitengwana Mashaban and Minister Molewa met in February and March respectively to start the handing over process and making the way forward for COP17 preparation. The main goal was to ensure that consultation, transparency and political issues are mapped out and considered from the beginning for the success of conferences of the parties. The three teams will continue to engage on all aspects of COP until South Africa signs a hosting agreement, which is anticipated in August this year. The negotiation process started, in the early April through the Bangkok negotiations, where the ad hoc working committees met to unpack the Cancun agreement and agree on the agenda for COP17, which would form the start of or the basis of negotiation process and the update to the South African position paper. This interactive session was for parties to engage in an open, inclusive and transparent discussion on general policy issues before deliberating on the more technical details and exchange of views in seeking to address ways to advance the unresolved issues relating to the work on adaptation, mitigation, technology transfer, finance and capacity building. You would recall that as we're moving forward, the deliberation would not only be on what transpired in Cancun, being what we have agreed upon or what we have not agreed upon. There are issues that are still outstanding, starting from the Bali, which, going to Cancun, they isolated some of the issues and left some which are still saying, South Africa, you need to attend to this during the COP17. So moving forward, the concentration or the deliberations would not only be focusing on Cancun agreements, but even from on the outstanding work prior to Cancun. South Africa has been, I would talk of South Africa rather than like a department because, it's a country, has been engaging with, parties on the basis of those who are, representing various groups within the Conference of Parties. Firstly, on all the countries that have been consulted, they have prioritized the technical work and workshops associated with the main and architectural elements and processes for the future climate change regime that were agreed, upon in Cancun. And look, like what you would see underlined there forms the basis of what was agreed upon in Bangkok in terms of the initial or preliminary agenda moving the discussions forward. And basically, on all the underlying issues, it was to deal with modalities and, the processes in terms of how to take this forward. Because if you were to recall, in Cancun, most of these issues were addressed, were agreed upon, and committees were formed. But in terms of the actual work or in-depth discussions in terms of how do we unpack this, how do we get there in terms of achieving what we have set for ourselves, it's what was expected to happen during the course of the year before, the COP17. Without going into each one of them, I would, request through you, Chair, that I move to slide 11. Basically, on each of those, it's just, to set a scene in terms of how were they going to be, unpacked, the modalities thereof. So in May, the outcome of, the Bangkok deliberations were presented to the IMC, and based on, the outcome of what transpired on the outreach parties and the IMC engagement, the proposals were made to the Interministerial Committee where the strategy in terms of how we are approaching the whole process as a country came up with, the following conclusions or, how we should be moving forward. One of the things was, as a country, we need to have a program of consultation with national stakeholders such as parliamentarians, local government, NGOs, business, labor, and other groupings that have interest in the process. And the agenda for this consultation should also, include consideration of an input into the draft national substantive content positions, as well as the development of possible compromise solutions to issues which are experiencing difficulty in the international negotiation process. Encouraging national stakeholders to participate in any international stakeholder meetings and lobby for possible compromises with their international, counterparts. We need also to mobilize national stakeholders to support, sponsor, and participate in the program to use COP17 as an opportunity to showcase both South Africa's climate change efforts, including marketing South African pavilion parallel to this and the side events. Also, the recommendation was to encourage national stakeholders to mobilize their international counterparts to actively participate in the COP conference. And the IMC, based on the report, gave the mandate to the negotiators team to led by the COP president and also Minister Mulewa to engage on the negotiations based on the preliminary UN agenda at the second session of the negotiations in Bonn, which has just, came to an end on Friday last week. As Peter has indicated, that the team has just came back, last weekend. A draft position paper will be developed after the Bonn negotiations for tabling to cabinet in August or September 2011. Basically, it would not be, starting from scratch. It would be updating what we had, before. So it's not like we're going to start from scratch. And when I'm talking about the negotiators team, I'm not talking about one department. It's an intergovernmental representation. So all sectors are represented in terms of taking issues forward. Department of Energy is part of, the negotiator team as well, including other departments. Basically, on the negotiating position, the key priority deals with the development, compilation, approval, and implementation of the South African COP17 negotiating position. As I've indicated, that it's not a new area of work. Basically, it's the processes that, would have been followed even in other COPs. However, as the COP president, there is now an important balancing act between what will constitute a successful COP. Peter has, indicated that previously. And the IMC recommended a far more public and inclusive consultation process where the provincial workshops will kick in around August. This process would be led by Department of Environmental Affairs, but all key departments would be part to it. With COP17, there is going to be a very high level of public interest, as you would have already noticed. The basic development plan includes getting in principle approval from an initial working South African position by end of July, update Cancun position in response to recent developments, present to IAMC, IGCC, and NCCC, and all the other structures that are relevant to the climate change process. So the list is not limited to the three committees that I've just indicated, and ultimately get, approval from Cabinet. Public engagement around the initial working South African position during the provincial summit, as proposed or indicated to the IGCC by Environmental Affairs, would start in August and September. And the position finalization is expected, to be submitted to Cabinet somewhere in October. Slide 14 and 15, it's tabling the proposed implementation plan for the development of the National Climate Change negotiating position in terms of various steps or processes that would be followed until the Cabinet approval in terms of mandating the team to go into the formal or the ultimate part of the negotiation process. And slide 16 just shows you the project plan in terms of what has been outlined under slide 14 and slide 15. In relation to the COP17 logistics, the UNFCCC will be held at the Durban ICC, and DECO is responsible to lead all the UN processes and supported by DIA on matters of substance, including all government departments serving on IMC. Logistics will be divided into two parts. We will have the UN precinct processes as well as the South African Expo exposition. which would be focusing on climate change and response. It should be noted that there is limited participation in the UNCCC processes, which allows only accredited participants and mainly country members and registered bodies or organizations under UN. The South African Expert, led by Environmental Affairs, will be hosted adjacent and at the same time as the UN conference. This expo is open to all South African businesses, government, organizations, NGOs, community-based organizations, and any other interest parties working in around climate change. And the advert to call for expression of interest was released from Environmental Affairs in May 2011. JA will, amongst others, be responsible for the coordination and management of the climate change and response expo to be held in the ICC Durban precinct, whereas COP17 is a tightly controlled event only open to registered delegates and press, as I've indicated. The objective of the expo are covered on slide 18. Basically, to raise awareness and educate the public about climate change in South Africa and the world. And like the expo should not be seen as the point where we're talking about, educating the public. The road shows or the provincial workshops that we have already highlighted on, that would be in August to September, would be part of making sure that, awareness on climate change issues is intensified before we get to the main session of climate change, and also to showcase both local and international initiatives and technologies that are at the forefront of climate change resilience. Mobilize South Africans across all sectors to act on climate change in all aspects of their lives. So we should not be talking about climate change because we are at work. Even at home, whatever we're doing, we should be climate change, inclined or conversant in terms of our daily activities. The expo would also be creating a platform for business, government and NGOs to showcase climate change initiatives and technologies in South Africa. Create a platform of all South Africans and international visitors to network and transfer knowledge and skills about climate change. And also initiate a lasting legacy, because we want to be talking, about the climate change negotiations the same way that we are crowding ourselves in relation to the World Cup and other major events that we have hosted successfully. On slide 19, that is specific COP17 logistics within the Department of Energy. To respond and implement action on the above mentioned, DOE participates on all the COP17 institutional structures such as the Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change, the National Committee on Climate Change, IMC, NEDLAG, and the International Negotiation Forums and Committees under the UN. Internally, we have established both an internal and external COP17 steering committee. On internal committee part of it, we're looking at making sure that all the necessary processes from the energy side and policy imperatives are taken into account when we're heading to the key negotiation sector. And externally, we need to make sure that the energy sector as a whole is taken into account and also as part of the team or collective decision in relation to matters of energy. We have conducted workshops on the proceedings of COP17 with the energy sector to ensure that energy issues are tackled as a collective rather than a government only or one entity. On the international forum, DOE has engaged the African Union on the need for African ministers of energy to participate on behalf of their respective countries on COP17 in February, and we have since received a positive response from AU affirming its support and participation thereof. As a build-up towards COP17 and ensuring that energy matters in the continent at large are addressed, DOE will be hosting a pre-COP17 African Ministers of Energy Conference scheduled to happen on the 15th and 16th of September 2011. Cabinet has approved the hosting of the conference on the 15th of June. Preparations on the conference have since started, with invitations expected to be out in 2 weeks' time. On this, I would indicate that, once the program has been finalized, details will also be shared with, the committee here. Continuing on the DOE side, the proposed African Ministers of Energy Conference and its input towards development of a sustainable energy on issues of mitigation, adaptation, strengthening regional power pools, interconnectivity thereof, scaling up of renewables, energy efficiency will guide actions and outlining financing possibilities for sustainable options of increasing clean energy access in Africa. We would acknowledge that, I mean, as much as we would be talking about this COP, we're not seeing it as a South African event. We're seeing it as an event for the continent as well. As much as Peter has indicated that as South Africa, we should understand that we're wearing two hats. I mean, as COP presidency, we're still having our own national position, which we need to align, I mean, in terms of our regional interests as well as continental issues. The international engagement. The conference will provide a platform for a high-level policy dialogue and its output, which will serve as an important input into COP17 discussions, where Africa's energy investment priorities should be considered as an important part of the international negotiations for the whole African continent. I would indicate that, like you would have recalled, that in terms of the IRP, we do have like an element of import hydro, which we need to engage even our neighboring countries in terms of how do we make sure that issues around energy infrastructure, issues around energy generation, I mean, are taken into account. So a collective decision in terms of Africa as a continent is required. Hence, it needs to input or inform the basis of how as a continent we collectively agreeing on certain issues. International engagements on COP17 with special focus to the energy sector led to, I mean, the World Bank offering its support on the hosting of this conference through the Department of Energy. So on the slide on recommendations, what we're saying is the committee to note progress made on COP17, including the proposed South African negotiation position, development and implementation plan, notes that Cabinet approved the South Africa to host the pre-COP African Ministers of Energy Conference scheduled to happen on the 15th and 16th in line with the UNFCCC agenda. Notes that the Department of Energy will extend the invitation to other key departments, stroke organizations, and ministers from African countries and other international organizations to participate in this pre-COP. I need to add on the recommendation that in terms of the project that would be showcased, I mean, at the expo, the department has been receiving a lot of, I mean, proposals in terms of those interested in, exhibiting during the COP. And we're doing that jointly with Department of Environmental Affairs, since it's the one that is coordinating on behalf of the country for the provisions that will be addressing the legacy part of it. But like we have not as yet, I mean, shortlisted, as we still need to finalize the issue around the exhibition area in terms of the space available and the key projects that are shortlisted in terms of, I mean, which of the best do we take and share with the world, because we have acknowledged that it's, I mean, true that not everything would be exhibited based on the limited space, and also we need to showcase the best practices that we're displaying in the country. And that would be it on the COP17 preparations. Thank you.
More than a mouthful. Thanks very much, Rally Wuchowski. Dr. Freiling Gerslau, Dr. Khadem.
Thank you, Chair. I noticed that you called me Tata Freiling. I said after my birthday last week. my point is a more general one, and I think it's directed not just at the Department of Energy, but I think at government as a whole around COP17. And I must say, and I've heard this from a number of people, this isn't just my impression too, is that a number of people have expressed the fact that there is hardly any publicity around COP17 at the moment. what is the plan in terms of publicizing this event? And the reason why I say this, though, is that, and I've heard it referred to a number of times, we want to have this like the success of the World Cup and things like that. This isn't a World Cup, though. This is something far more different. This isn't a World Cup. With a World Cup, we need to get the logistics right, build the stadiums, invite the teams, and then there's a winner at the end of the day, and we can all take pride in it. The outcome is not necessarily guaranteed. And this COP is happening at a time where it's crucial we get some kind of an outcome, we get a good outcome, not only for the world, but for Africa. And it's been held in Africa. And we need to start to build the momentum towards that. To just have an African energy minister's meeting, I don't think is going to cut it. We need to involve the whole of Africa in terms of civil society, in terms of that outrage that Mr. Luki was talking about, and the kind of global injustice that climate change represents. You know, where is this momentum, where is this build up towards actually showing the world, showing the press, showing those countries that come to Durban in December, that Africa is being affected, Africa wants a sustainable outcome from this conference, and how are we as the COP president going to ensure that we actually get that message across? And to do that is going to require a lot of work across the board, not just between government departments, not just between African countries, but in terms of bringing the whole of civil society on board in this as well. And it's just a message to government that we really need to start to build this momentum, because I've not seen it at the moment. Thank you.
Chairman, part of what I needed to say has been said. But just to link that, when we look at this program that will be unfolding up to and including that period, that program ends in November. A finalized chairman approved documents will only be produced in November. And in December we will have a conference. This plan, I think, is a plan for the people. It's not a plan for the entire society in line that we want to program. And whereas we need it, very well we should say both these presentations refer to documents that are not here. The first presentation was presented about the green paper that is elsewhere, it's not here. And the second document is presenting a working document that takes what the position of the executive is going to be as it discussed, other ministers in Africa, and as it presents maybe the Africa position. At the COP 17. But this does not include Parliament, this does not include the civil society, this does not include the other people. It's really a gender program of this. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairperson, I didn't hear. Maybe I was not listening attentively, but if I can be able to be given clarity in terms of the exhibitions, that yes, we are planning space for exhibitions and all the stuff. But I know exhibitions, you know, you speaking in terms of all the technologies that we produce in South Africa. Yeah. But I'm just looking in terms of, you know, there are those people who like to put their extra exhibitions outside to like to sell things for the foreigners to come. I'm looking at an instance whereby people of KZN benefiting in terms of the economy when they are selling things outside. I don't want to see an instance whereby, you know, there was that conference that was held in ICC in Devon where people were chased out by police, run around like headless chickens. It cannot happen. Because if COP 17 will come to South Africa, it must bring also sense of change to say people they can also benefit. Those who sell traditional attires, beads and all that stuff, they can also, you know, have their space somewhere around that area so that they can set. They, so that we avoid a space whereby they are chased by police. The last question, I don't know, man. Usually these funds that comes with the World Bank and other stuff, they always have conditions. I don't know what are the conditions of that funding. And what is expected out of us, because we don't have to find ourselves at a certain stage. We're expected, you know, to pay back that fund as South Africa. But what is the conditions within those funds? Thanks.
The last point, I nearly said, "Viva, you sleep." Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes whatever we want to suppress just comes out like a cock in the water. This is very helpful, also. Pretty helpful. You know why? Amongst other things, is that the summit of the African Union decided that there will be an African pavilion in Durban. Now, when there's an SAX, or the question I have, how will it relate to the African pavilion? Because my understanding is that once COP17 is hosted by South Africa, but it's an African baby. We take pride of ourselves as doing things on behalf of Africa. Like the World Cup, because it was hosted by South Africa, but we had to ensure that all Africans throughout the continent are proud of it. So let's make sure that through you, the Secretary of the Committee, and myself, we sort that out. Because the President of the country was at the EU summit. The President of this country agreed to an African pavilion. And if it doesn't relate now to our own South African Expo, love the vote. The second one is that the first two speakers had a point, because with my Pan-African Parliament head, we lost out. We wanted also to have our own little spaza shop of Ozozo there. But we were beaten by the deadline. And amongst other things, is because COP17 has not been popularized enough. I don't know why, because this is our opportunity in Africa, poor as we are. And more than anything, this is not a World Cup kicking a ball. It's about people's lives. And we need to be quite honest at times that if we haven't done our job, we haven't done our job. I'm not pointing fingers to anyone. There should have been adequate publicity long ago. I'm taking just as an example, and I'm really scared that they'll be hyped as we move towards November, December. The only problem is that once the venue starts getting active, it doesn't belong to South Africa, it belongs to the United Nations. And the United Nations, as I've experienced in Copenhagen in particular, it's very, very strict and stringent. You know, maybe we need to be quite innovative about the latecomers and see how they can be accommodated, so that at least they can be able to relate to whatever activities that take place there. But any climate change conference is very active. You know, we're not talking of less than 30,000 people moving up and down. So that being the case, I'm sure all, even these preparations, Bungane, are helpful just to indicate to us what's going to happen and how we can integrate with it. And it's even helpful in any case, the presentation, because it will become a propellant to me to ensure that in our other platform here in Parliament, we really move with haste, because there are overlapping things here, like the National Stakeholders Consultation Initiative,
we need to be honest, you know, at times that here is the silo syndrome or parallel process emerging because we are not coordinating our efforts adequately enough. With all the good intention, and alignment point, with all the good intentions, because we need to ensure that we do things in South Africa. I think that's what Honorable Rusla was saying. It's not a matter of an executive initiative, it's a legislature initiative, it's a South African initiative, whereby each and every stakeholder or grouping plays its role. But it's not that late. Let's make sure that we synchronize and coordinate our activities. This is just one opportunity, as it was said at some stage. This is an African century, and Africa must really provide not just leadership, but quality leadership. There were some questions, if you just address them. Thank you.
Chair, I can respond to some of them, because they relate certainly to the work that we're doing. Chair, you touched on the aspect around publicity around COP. You already touched on one of the aspects, that in terms of, and I think it's quite clear, this whole thing is not a World Cup. South Africans do not go to COP. South African negotiators go to COP. It's a United Nations thing. There are 37,000 people that are probably going to be involved. Well, that's the kind of figures that are around there. And as you're aware, through your involvement in the United Nations as well, I mean, it's only accredited people that go into the COP. So building publicity around an event that is actually an exclusive event may not be the best way to do. Building publicity around the importance of the event is exceptionally important. And with that, we have an entire program that is starting to roll out. The first small elements of that program have started in the media now, and it'll be ramping up over time. We're going to... It's not just media, so it's not just newspaper adverts and what have you, but it's through radio, TV, and what have you. We already have a series of 3-minute climate change dramas that are playing out in community radio stations around the country, starting on the 1st of June. And that is already starting this program, and it's going to basically snowball as time goes on. And then with a series of provincial climate change workshops that will be happening in every single province in August and September, we'll be trying to ramp up the level of public awareness around these issues, around those particular events. So though you may not be feeling a lot of publicity now, because it's still early days, we don't want to have a sort of situation where people start getting bored with the idea of climate change before we get to COP. We've got an entire and very well-planned program of media outreach and outreach programs that are going to basically highlight that COP. But COP is just basically an event that we're going to tie things to. It's not going to be the focus of the media. The focus of the media is around climate change response and the importance of it. And within that, the importance of an international agreement. And so with that, hopefully that will raise the awareness around it. These security services have already received an indication that there will be a march at COP. And the NGO coalition has said that there will be 50,000 people marching, which is going to be very interesting, to say the least. So in terms of that, I mean, there are some mobilization elements that are happening globally around the COP, and it's important that we publicize the importance of the COP so people can actually contextualize this as well. In terms of the point that was made that around, and you're absolutely correct, I mean, the whole negotiating position and stuff around October, November, near the COP and what have you, that is really just the internal processes. The external processes are the awareness things. We need to have, by the time we get to COP, our portfolio committees have said, Peter, from you, I want you to promise me that when people come to South Africa for the COP and they speak to any South African must be able to say in an intelligible fashion what they understand to be climate change, what is climate change and what the issues are of importance. And that's been a challenge that's put forward by our parliamentary portfolio committee, which we're taking very seriously. So over the next couple of months, you will start seeing a very strong and heightened level of awareness raising around this as much as we possibly can within the resources that are available to us. In terms of the expo itself, this is a South African Inc. expo. We've got, and we must be very, very careful here. First of all, it's outside the COP precinct, but it's right outside the COP precinct. So in other words, delegates are going to have to walk through the expo in order to get into the conference of the parties. We have very limited area. It's
10,000 square meters, which means that, for instance, we have to be very, very focused about what goes into the expo. It's not an open invitation to everybody, for the simple reason that it has to be a semi-commercial event on the one hand, but we need to cross-subsidize observing organizations to be there too. So within that, there's a very clear indication of the people who will be involved in the expo are participants that are actually doing tangible changes from a climate change response. It's not people with good ideas, it's people that are actually doing stuff. And within that, there must be a clear balance between industry, civil society, government, labor, and so on and so forth. So there's a proper representation of the South African community, including the good stuff that we're doing and the challenges we have. In terms of the actual selling inside the expo, there will be a sort of situation, but it's not going to be a free-for-all either. I mean, we're not going to have vendors selling illegal DVDs and stuff like that. We're going to have situations where there are people that are actually selling products that are made from the Working for Water projects, for example, where there's an actual intervention, which is a climate change intervention that is looking at invasive alien species and utilizing those alien species to create furniture and this and stuff. With that as well, there's a growing organic food, agricultural sector in South Africa as well. So to actually have food that is good, healthy African food, what have you, and they basically provide this sort of thing as well. The intention really is, and we know how negotiators work, and Chair, you would have had this experience as well. Negotiators travel from their hotel to the venue, they go into the venue, they sit there and negotiate. In the evening, they go back to their hotel, they don't even see the country. So what we're going to try and do is create an expo that actually has some level of excitement that will actually draw these negotiators in to see what is happening through smells of good food and coffee and these kind of things that will attract people in. So we're going to be quite opportunistic here, to be honest. But the expo is not for the delegates alone. We'll have the expo kind of close to the public from 8 until 10 o'clock every day so that the delegates can move through. But from then it becomes a public thing, and what we want to see is school buses and these sort of things arriving to see what South Africa, how South Africa was responding. In terms of the African COP and the Africa Pavilion, one of the things that has come through is that it's quite clear that in terms of this being an African COP, it's not the first African COP, Nairobi was the first one, this is the second. But it's not a case of calling it an African COP as some sort of like a sort of a greenwashing type affair. You know, so that, for instance, in the venue we have a couple of baskets and some beads and whatever. That is not the intention. What will make this an African COP is actually within the negotiations itself, is that we start bringing up adaptation that has the same kind of urgency as mitigation from an African perspective. Because that is the reality, is that in terms of Africa being the victims of greenhouse gas emissions, that's exactly the truth. The focus within an African COP must be on how do we actually save African lives and how do we actually support adaptation measures that are in response to climate change that are no fault of their own. So that in itself will start giving it an African signature, simply to start moving not moving the focus away, but balancing our mitigation and our adaptation efforts. With that said, the African Union decision in terms of an African pavilion will be as we have with the European pavilions as well, is that will be a formal pavilion within the COP precinct. So in other words, it is in the United Nations precinct. And so that is already being discussed, basically in response to the African Union decision. That doesn't mean, for instance, that South Africa is going to basically hog the entire space. The reality is, of course, the South African Expo is going to be a South African Expo. It's going to be around South African products, South African services, what we can do, and what have you. But that doesn't mean that the areas around us are going to be completely exclusive South African. We have to basically open up the exhibition space, basically almost cross-subsidize ourselves. In terms of supporting the South African Expo, it's an expensive event. It will cost around 57 million rand. From the revenue stream, we expect to get about 27 million out of that. So there's a shortfall, which we have to try and get through cross-subsidization. And the way that we're going to try and do that is we're getting proper donor and sponsorship managers in to assist us here, is through careful branding and marketing opportunities, but also being very, very careful there, because we don't want to have a sort of situation where our major pavilion, the South African pavilion, is branded with Coca-Cola, for example. I mean, that would just be inappropriate. So we, you know, Can you imagine? I mean, so we have to be quite careful about this. But the reality is that what we'll try and do is we'll try and find exhibition space for other countries that are showing a dramatic amount of interest, and that's mostly the Scandinavian countries. The US is also interested. Japan is very interested in having their own exhibition and what have you. And what we'll try and do is provide them with space and at the same time try and utilize that the opportunity and the rental of that space to try and cross-subsidize and increase the quality of the South African pavilion. So that's, in essence, where we are going with this whole sort of process. So my final word in this, Chair, is that even though you may not have seen a huge amount of hype about this on the one hand, I don't think you will see a huge amount of hype about the COP itself, but you'll start seeing an increasing level of public outreach and awareness raising around climate change and stuff, and the COP will be contextualized in that process. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Luke.
Okay. I think Peter has responded to, all the exhibition issues. I will respond to your question in terms of the World Bank, support. There are no conditions attached. Let me just indicate that, through the AU, some of the countries highlighted the challenges in terms of financial constraints. And looking at the nature of, the engagement that is required at the continental level, it's South Africa would not be in a position to pay for all the ministers, to come here. So the support is more like supporting the experts and other African, countries' participation in this regard. It's not a loan, it's just to support us. They wouldn't be transferring any money to the Department of Energy. They will run with the process themselves in terms of their own procurement processes, in terms of how they support, those who would want to participate in the conference. So there wouldn't be any money that would be transferred, to Department of Energy, as in like a grant to our own account through maybe National Treasury. So there are no conditions attached to it at all. It's just a support in making sure that all the participants required, as the request has already been laid with the AU in terms of requesting that on this occasion they would want to participate and they would want some support. Thanks.
Just to get it clarified, I didn't get that clear. The issue of procurement is related to.
I'm saying there would not be any money transferred to us as a department or National Treasury, in terms of their own processes within the World Bank. They will handle all the processes in terms of how do they support participation on these events. So the procurement process is in relation to accommodation, tickets related, stipend for the countries that cannot, afford to come to South Africa and be part of this process. Thanks.
Thank you very much. All of us, because we started late, we're running into lunch hour meetings, as you can sense. Members have already started darting out. Ken, I then thank both departments' representatives for their instructive inputs. Very helpful. It's a good start. We're amongst the lucky committees to have had this exposure. And I trust and hope we'll share with other members as well, because of that we are in other committees, and the rest of the House. Also, can I just try my luck? The strategic plan, Secretary, can we adopt it now that people have left? Because I really wanted us to adopt this. Can we? No, we can't, unfortunately. I should have just held the devil Lord. But please, let's make sure that we'll make it the first thing on Friday. But I remember the other thing is that we left a meeting on Friday to try and catch up because of the disablement that is caused by the budget votes throughout May and early this month. We'll be dealing with NASA and NEXA to do their briefing. And I really appeal that we do our best to attend because of
the vitality of those two utilities. You know, a lot has been coming up, particularly, you know, on terrorists, refugees, this and that, so it would be helpful. Other than that, NERSA would be briefing us about their activities, but we take the opportunity to just engage them on that matter. NERSA, obviously, without any doubt, will take our opportunity to start handling, you know, nuclear power issues. Just to sneak a small thing as well, I'll still be doing my level best to ensure that at some stage we have the two departments coming, economic development and DTI, on the green economy. It's very important, you know, I can see the person who wears the two heads nodding, because we are energy, but we need to have a sense as to what is our contribution to the 5 million jobs called by the president through, in the context of the green economy, particularly the renewable energy component. And please, energy, once again, I'm sure you send someone just to, you know, keep an ear, not an eye, on that matter. Unfortunately, once again, that was destabilized by this budget, but we'll see whether we can have a special deal on that. Otherwise, I am sure all of members, we've had quite an earful today. And please, as another regular.
Is there anything that you'd like to take out of both departments? They are an email away. That would be very fantastic. Thanks for the visit to come, PMG, and the rest.